Deep.
Stories that really linger with you.
There's a real variety.
Then hear them for yourself every weekday afternoon next week at 3:30.
This is a great selection of five stories that will tell you something about our world now.
The BBC National Short Story Award 2024 with Cambridge University on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 11th of September. It's good to be with you. Good to have your company. This is Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning: Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have repeatedly accused each other of lying during their televised presidential debate. The vice president seemed to have a plan to upset and goad Donald Trump, for instance, on the size of his rallies.
And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom.
First, let me respond as to the rallies. She said people start leaving. People don't go to her rallies. There's no reason to go.
And one other headline: the Foreign Secretary David Lammy and his U.S. counterpart Anthony Blinken are visiting Ukraine to show their support and to discuss the use of long-range Western missiles.
Also in today's programme, ahead of Lord Darzi's major report into the state of the NHS being published tomorrow, we'll hear from a former Trust executive about what remedies we can expect and the problems. And in her first broadcast interview, we'll hear from Aurelie Boas, the wife of the aid worker Simon Boas, who died in July, days after appearing on this programme, after attracting a global audience for writing so inspirationally about his terminal cancer diagnosis and his feelings towards life and death in his local newspaper.
I had to remind myself very often that, you know, it's not about me, all of this. If it's helping millions, and I think it has, and it will, it's something I need to do, I need to share.
All that coming up. And could just keep playing that to you, but we can't. The conductor and composer Jules Buckley will be here to talk about performing alongside the incredible Florence Welch, she of Florence and the Machine, this evening at the Proms. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The two candidates to be President of the United States have argued about crime, immigration, abortion and the economy in the first televised debate of the campaign. The event in Philadelphia began with a handshake before Kamala Harris and Donald Trump repeatedly accused each other of lying. The vice president said Mr. Trump would offer tax cuts to billionaires, while the former president said Ms. Harris had made the US into a failing country. Our North America editor Sarah Smith was watching the debate.
A combative Kamala Harris clearly intended to try to rile Donald Trump, and she obviously succeeded in getting under his skin. He looked distinctly rattled, as she said he was fired by millions of voters at the last election, that people leave his campaign rallies early because they get bored, and that he's disrespected on the world stage. Unaccustomed to being on the defensive, Donald Trump stuck closely to his most familiar talking points, constantly referring to the high numbers of illegal migrants entering America, saying they're committing crimes, and even claiming, without evidence, that they're killing people's pets. Afterwards, Donald Trump claimed this was his best debate yet, as he made a surprise appearance in the media center, just as the Harris campaign suggested doing another debate next month. Kamala Harris's performance was far from flawless, but she obviously thinks she came out on top, which is why she wants to do it all again before Election Day.
Moments after the broadcast finished, Kamala Harris was boosted by an endorsement from Taylor Swift. Writing on Instagram, the pop singer said the Democratic candidate fought for the rights and causes she believed in. She said she felt she had to make the announcement after an AI deepfake reposted by Donald Trump appeared to show her endorsing him. The Foreign Secretary David Lammy and his US counterpart Anthony Blinken are visiting Ukraine in a joint demonstration of support for the country. They'll discuss President Zelensky's demands to use long-range American and British missiles against targets in Russia. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landell is travelling with the Foreign Secretary and has sent this report.
This is the first joint overseas visit by a foreign secretary and US Secretary of State for more than a decade. A trip designed, officials say, to emphasise unified transatlantic support for Ukraine. But what leaders in Kyiv want is not so much support, but permission. The right to use American and British long-range missiles against targets in Russia. So far, that permission has been withheld amid US fears of Russian escalation. But Antony Blinken said he and Mr. Lammy wanted to hear directly from President Zelensky what he wants.
The Palestinian Red Crescent has said that Israeli strikes in the occupied West Bank have killed 5 people. The Israeli military said its aircraft had hit a terrorist cell during an operation in Tubas. The government will introduce a bill to Parliament today that'll see the biggest overhaul in England's rental market in more than 3 decades. The Renters' Rights Bill will ban so-called no-fault evictions, which campaigners say are a leading cause of homelessness. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
If the name of the bill sounds familiar, that's because it is. The previous Conservative government also had a renters' bill that similarly pledged to scrap no-fault evictions, whereby a landlord can remove a tenant simply because they want their property back. But despite being a Tory party manifesto pledge in 2019, the previous bill wasn't passed. Now the new government is promising to scrap no-fault evictions, as well as giving tenants other rights, including the right to keep a pet, to ban landlords from refusing tenants simply because they're on benefits, and to put a timescale on how quickly private landlords must undertake repairs.
A number of Labour MPs say they'll keep pressing the government to provide support for pensioners in England and Wales who are losing their winter fuel payments. 50 Labour MPs either abstained or were absent from yesterday's Commons vote, which backed the government's plan. The BBC says at least 20 are opposed to the policy. Downing Street says the measure is necessary to deal with a budget deficit. The National Farmers Union is warning that its ambition to make UK farming net zero by 2040 is in doubt. The NFU says a lack of investment in climate-friendly agriculture schemes by the previous government has made that target much tougher to deliver. Here's our rural affairs correspondent, Malcolm Pryor.
Farming accounts for 12% of the UK's greenhouse gas emissions. 5 years ago, the NFU set a target to help farmers reach net zero 10 years before the rest of the economy. But today it says that aim has become, in its words, tricky to meet, and it's calling on the government to up its annual UK farming budget from £3.5 billion to £5.6. The government says it is still committed to reducing emissions in the farming sector, as well as protecting food security.
Amazon is to invest £8 billion in the UK over the next 5 years to create massive data centres to support the growth of cloud computing and artificial intelligence. The company says the move will ultimately lead to around 14,000 jobs.
Thank you. 6:07. To the weather. Sarah Keith Lucas is at the BBC Weather Centre this morning. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Good morning to you, Justin. Well, we've got quite a chilly autumnal feel to the weather today. A cold air mass coming in from the northwest, and that's bringing a mix of some sunshine, but quite a lot of frequent blustery showers as well, most of them across the northwest of the UK. So we'll start with the area seeing the most frequent showers. That's through Wales, northwest England, southwest Scotland, northern Scotland, and Northern Ireland. Showers from the word go, really, and some of them have got a bit of a wintry feel over the highest ground of Scotland. They'll be hit and miss through the day, blown through quite quickly on that brisk wind. There's a risk of some hail and potentially some thunderstorms mixed in, especially later on in the afternoon, but some sunshine in between and highs here around 10 to 13 degrees. But for the rest of the UK, so that's all of southern England through the Midlands, eastern England, northeast England and eastern Scotland, chilly start, temperatures down in mid-single figures. Plenty of dry, sunny weather through the morning, but as cloud bubbles up through the day, we'll see some showers moving through in the afternoon, some hail, some thunderstorms in the mix. But again, they'll be fairly well scattered, those showers. 12 to 15 degrees our top temperature later on. Overnight tonight, most of the showers are going to ease away, just a few continuing in the northwest, but quite a chilly night, temperatures down to 2 or 3 degrees in the rural spots further north. Heading into tomorrow then, similar to today, sunshine and showers, but not quite as many showers as today, not quite as breezy either, and things turn a little bit drier and more settled towards the end of the week.
Sarah, thank you. 6:08. How do you win a debate against Donald Trump? You goad him, you needle him. That was the Kamala Harris plan in the ABC News presidential debate, and she went to it with great gusto. She had memorised lines that she thought would hurt him, for instance, on the size of his rallies.
You will see during the course of his rallies, he talks about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. He will talk about windmills cause cancer. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom.
First, let me respond to the rallies. She said people start leaving. People don't go to her rallies. There's no reason to go. And the people that do go, she's busing them in and paying them to be there and then showing them in a different light. So she can't talk about that. People don't leave my rallies.
In one exchange on immigration, the former President Trump referenced a claim made by someone on social media that migrants have been eating pets in Springfield, Ohio. They're eating the dogs, they're eating the pets of the people that live there, he said, something the ABC moderator David Muir picked up on.
I just want to clarify here, you bring up Springfield, Ohio, and ABC News did reach out to the city manager there. He told us there have been no credible reports of specific claims of pets being harmed, injured, or abused by individuals within the immigrant community.
Well, I've seen people on television.
Let me just say here, this is the
people on television say my dog was taken and used for food. So maybe he said that, and maybe that's a good thing to say for a city manager.
I'm not taking this from
but
television.
But the people
I'm
on television saying
manager.
Their dog was eaten by the people that went there.
Again, the Springfield city manager says there's no evidence of that. Vice
we'll
President Harris,
out.
I'll let you respond to the rest of what you've heard.
You talk about extreme.
At the end of the debate, both candidates summed up their main arguments to the American people. Kamala Harris pitching herself as the change candidate.
I think you've heard tonight two very different visions for our country. One that is focused on the future and the other that is focused on the past and an attempt to take us backward. But we're not going back.
Donald Trump, meanwhile, right at the end of the debate, something he hadn't managed to do during it, tried to pin the record of the Biden administration on the vice president, Kamala Harris.
So she just started by saying she's going to do this, she's going to do that, she's going to do all these wonderful things. Why hasn't she done it? She's been there for 3.5 years. They've had 3.5 years to fix the border. They've had 3.5 years to create jobs and all the things we talked about. Why hasn't she done it?
And two follow-up thoughts, Emma. There was quite a lot of drama after the debate. Number one, Donald Trump went to the spin room and said it's the best debate he's ever done. But he also said, interestingly, he didn't know whether he's going to do another one. And there is some vague plan for another one, but it seems that it might or might not happen. Plus, Taylor Swift, 280 million followers on Instagram, saying after the debate that she was going to endorse Kamala Harris. Not a massive surprise, but still something that's very welcome to them.
More analysis to come on that. And there was also some commentary about the height difference which was being made.
Yes.
The talk of Kamala Harris from the Trump side of things being 5'3" and having a smaller podium and being smaller generally. So perhaps a line of inquiry, Justin, that you might be looking
well,
into.
Well, it's true that American presidents generally in the past have been the tallest.
Yes.
The taller one has normally won, I think I'm right in saying. But
there we go. We're going to analyse what was said, not necessarily how they looked, but we're on radio, so we've got to describe these things as well. Let's have a look at the papers then. There's several front pages. Of course, the debate was finishing just as Justin and I were coming in this morning, so not with the front pages to do with that, which is why we can bring you the latest. But several front pages focus on the early release of prisoners in England and Wales yesterday. The Daily Telegraph has a photo of a heavily tattooed offender giving the thumbs up as he was freed from Durham jail. Cheers, Keir, is the headline. The paper's cartoonist Matt addresses concerns about rehabilitation. He depicts inmates leaving the prison under a sign saying, "Thanks for staying. See you again soon."
There's a picture on the front page of the Mail of a prisoner at Nottingham jail being sprayed with champagne, described in the caption as sickening celebrations. The Mail lists other incidents it's outraged by, including one offender being greeted by friends in a Lamborghini, another vowing he's now a lifelong Labour voter.
The Sun dismisses the release scheme as a day of shame for the justice system, but its opinion column acknowledges that the circumstances which have led to it are not all the new government's fault. It points out that the overcrowding dates back at least to Tony Blair's era.
The Eye concentrates on the Commons' vote on government plans to restrict winter fuel payments to only the poorest pensioners. It believes that the approval of the move by MPs is going to embolden the Labour leadership. But the paper's editorial argues that even though Sir Keir Starmer's team may have dodged a disaster, there are signs of trouble ahead. It sees difficulty in next month's budget, which it warns will be full of thorny clauses on taxes and spending.
The Guardian's opinion column suggests that Sir Keir should take the win and let the matter rest there. It believes the Prime Minister needs to move on from his drive to improve the fiscal conditions of the UK and instead focus on the business of fixing public services like the NHS. The government, it states, must make the right choices, not just tough choices, and the Mirror agrees. It points out that Sir Keir and his ministers ought to be coaxing the public's attention back to what the paper judges to be much is what is good in what the government is doing.
According to the Financial Times, India's Tata Group is very close to a deal to release £500 million of taxpayers' money to support greener steelmaking at its plant at Patalbhut. The paper says it's been told by the chairman of Tata's holding company that talks aiming for a possible agreement have been going well. The FT suggests ministers could make an announcement about it today.
And finally, The Times is one of several papers bowled over by a new exhibition of works by Vincent van Gogh at the National Gallery in London. The headline states, "Believe the hype, this is a once-in-a-century starburst." The paper says that the show focuses on the Dutch master's feverishly productive years before his death in 1880, bringing together his most spectacular paintings. The Guardian, which has one of van Gogh's self-portraits on the front page, agrees. It concludes, the show is heart-stopping, an exhibition that loves the painter as he deserves to be loved. Well, I sound sold to that.
Quarter past six is the time.
Today, David Lammy will visit Kyiv with his US counterpart, Antony Blinken. The first joint overseas visit by a foreign secretary and US Secretary of State for more than a decade, and it's designed to demonstrate joint support for Ukraine. It comes as we're told President Biden is not ruling out allowing Ukraine to fire missiles deep into Russian territory. James Landau, our diplomatic correspondent, is travelling with both politicians on a train right now, I believe. James, good morning.
Good morning. Yes. Well, we're on the train. I can't tell you where we are, but we're heading towards the Ukrainian capital, where, as you say, the key issue is this question of whether or not the West, specifically the United States and the United Kingdom, are going to loosen the rules that they have applied to the long-range missiles they've been supplying to Ukraine. The Ukrainian ask is very, very clear. They want to use these missiles deeper into Russian territory so they can attack the air bases in particular that the Russians are using to launch their glide bombs against Ukraine, to devastating effect. The Americans thus far have always resisted this because they feared escalation, but there are signals now that American policy is changing. President Biden was asked if his policy was going to change last night, and he said, "We are working that out right now." Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, said yesterday that this issue would be discussed today, and then Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, would discuss it with President Biden when they meet in Washington on Friday. So clearly, there is a process of policy development. I don't think they're quite there yet, but it's changing.
This trip is an important one, though, isn't it, in terms of that show of unity and where this might be going, and also what's been learnt about Iran?
Yeah, well, that's the sort of the new fact in this equation, that yesterday, after multiple reports elsewhere, the US and the UK finally confirmed that, in their view, Iran was supplying short-range ballistic missiles to Russia, and that capability could potentially give Russia a freer hand to use its own longer-range missiles against targets deeper within Ukraine. So that is a factor that people think is going to shape the leech right now. But you're right, it's an important moment, simply because Ukraine, although it's made some gains in the Kursk region, taking the fight to Russia, taking some Russian territory there, it is also losing ground steadily in the east, in Donetsk, and it is also taking substantial hits from Russian strikes against its infrastructure, which is a regular tactic now of the Russians before the winter. And so this is a demonstration today of political support that the Ukrainians hope will be matched in coming days with policy change that will give them, a greater chance to defend themselves.
James Landau, good luck with that trip. As you can hear, our diplomatic correspondent travelling with both politicians, David Lammy and Antony Blinken, Foreign Secretary and his US counterpart, on a train right now.
18 minutes past six, the government is expected to confirm a grant of £500 million to Tata Steel today. We were talking about this to Simon Jack yesterday and talking about the prospect of job losses at Tata Steel. Those losses, it seems, are still going to go ahead. They're possibly not quite in the numbers we were expecting. Sean has more detail on that and indeed the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Yes, Justin. So, it could be more than 2,500 jobs still to go, but as part of a package that we're going to hear more detail of from the government today, that £500 million could be on its way. I'm going to talk to somebody from the metals industry in a moment about what all that means. First, I wanted to just check in with the World Skills 2024 competition that's getting underway in Lyon today. So this brings together young people from 65 different countries to test their skills across six different sectors, from manufacturing, engineering, creative arts, fashion. For the UK, it comes at a time when the government's looking to address a skills shortage. Here, many bosses telling us about that this time of the morning with its new Skills England body, reforms to the apprenticeship levy as well. What's going to be required? Here's one of those over in Lyon, Ruby, who spent 2 years honing her fine dining skills.
You start most of the basic skills in college, and now at international level, they are the highest level of skills you can ever have in the industry. So it is very hard. It takes a lot of time, but once you've got them, they can't be taken away from you.
Now, I'm joined in the studio here in Salford by Brian Holliday, who's the Managing Director of Digital Industries at Siemens UK, one of the sponsors of the event, big employer here in Britain. Brian, morning to you.
Morning.
Well, what for you is it about, you know, your links with the event, showcasing our skills, compared to the conversations we will often have about our struggles to get the skills we need here in the UK?
Absolutely. And I think what you've highlighted just a moment ago, a skills shortage, many firms are reporting that technical and vocational skills actually being incredibly important if we're thinking about ways in which we need to boost the economy. But Siemens has supported WorldSkills since 2011, and we're tremendously proud to have two of our apprentices actually competing in Lyon as part of the current final there.
So good luck to them going for gold. I just wonder, over your period of time then, seeing what the rest of the world is doing, because that seems to be a key part of this, is when you've got entrants from all over the world. And of course, for the individuals, there could be great success, and it's a brilliant step in their career that they're taking if they manage to win a medal and even just compete in the first place. But you will be talking to your peers from around the world. Are they having the same issues as us, or has the UK had got some pointed issues when it comes to getting the skills we need?
I think we've got a slightly more acute problem here. I mean, some of the challenges we've faced, of course, include the signposting of the vocational training routes, perhaps a skills mismatch. And, you know, Skills England, hopefully, will be part of the answer to really do a review of, what are the demands that industry has so that employers can really highlight where we need more people in industry. And the technical and vocational skills are critical. So
how can there be a skills mismatch still? Yeah. This is an issue that's been raised a long time ago, where when you see the education system leading into vocational qualifications, university qualifications, and then people having a job in businesses like yours. Where along the line is the key issue?
I suspect we could start with signposting. We've got schools that typically signpost academic pathways more than perhaps apprenticeship. So I think, WorldSkills is critical actually for learners, for parents, for educators to appreciate that we do have these vocational pathways that we need more of. And employers, say roughly between half and two thirds are reporting shortages in these areas. So I think, it's critical that we do more to boost also the prestige of technical and vocational education. We've got a bit of a parity of esteem issue here as well. And I think this is critical to show that, we can be world class at these activities, and we need to do more of this. So it's a great opportunity to showcase routes to careers that perhaps young people aren't necessarily having signposted.
But that issue, the reputation almost of these, some of these industries that we're talking about, that's not a new issue either. So are there certain things that you at Siemens would like to be doing with schools to help with that signposting that there's a blocker on?
We'd like to see many more structured routes through which employers could engage with schools. So careers advice at the moment is something that's broken. And one of the ways that we're trying to address that is we've actually taken through, over the last 2 years, over 10,000 students through virtual work experience. So we've gone directly to learners in a way that scales to give them an experience of the world of work. So that's one way in which we could, also help improve the situation.
Is there more, though, that actually, if that's what you need, and Siemens is a big business with big budgets, that you could just decide to do more yourself, in the areas where you're headquartered, even just right across the country, there's an opportunity here for big businesses who want these skills to just get the money together themselves and get in those schools directly?
Potentially we could, but I think we do need to have a joined up conversation with government, with industry and with educators. And I hope that's what Skills England will give us the opportunity to start. I mean, I hope we're a responsible employer in recruiting. I mean, presently having over 600 interns, apprentices and graduates on our books. So we're recruiting hopefully beyond our needs, and also supplying curriculum content into education schemes that I think will help others. So that really matters when you're using the sort of technologies that we do, like Ben Yelland and Lucy Ben Love and Lucy Yelland, our two apprentices, are working on at the World Skills Competition. These are the operational technologies that run the world. So there are many companies that are going to benefit from the types of apprenticeship training that we're putting together and the ways in which we're trying to help create the right standards for the sort of technologies that that are covered.
I wanted to bring Altaf Kassam into this conversation, Managing Director and Investor at State Street Global Advisors. Morning, Altaf.
Good morning.
When you look at the state of the UK economy, you hear the government saying we're going for growth. We had numbers yesterday, you know, on the jobs market showing unemployment down, but vacancies falling once again. Where is the skills issue there in the story of our jobs market at the moment as you see it?
I think, I mean, the skills issue for us working in investments is generally around technical skills. So I know that there's been a push, but like you say, it's been a push for a while. We still find that we're looking for more candidates who have technical skills like coding, like decent maths and statistics. And as I said before, like the ability to kind of put those together and present them as well. And that's a softer skill. But I think that those three together, the combination of technical, computing and presentation skills, are what makes a killer candidate or a great person to hire.
Brian, you're expecting a gold medal to be coming back to Siemens offices today. Is the pressure on?
Well, of course, they've got a few days. The competition doesn't finish until the 15th, but no, absolutely we are.
Brian, good luck to your colleagues over there. Brian Holliday, Managing Director of Digital Industries at Siemens UK, a sponsor of that World Skills 2024 event. Altaf, a few other things I wanted to ask you about. Apple, a lot of big tech company questions as well. Apple being told to pay $14 billion in unpaid taxes to Ireland. This, an order by the European Union's highest court. Is Apple going to actually have to cough that up? And what are the consequences for it?
Yeah, I think the consequences are much broader than just one company. So it's about the whole sector. Other technology companies may face increased scrutiny from tax authorities. They may feel the need to change their corporate structure. All that could increase costs. And then the question is whether those costs will be passed on to the consumers like you and I, or whether the companies will eat that and that will hurt their margin and their stock price. So this is potentially a big, big decision.
And Amazon, to look at the big announcement we've heard this morning that it's making an investment of £8 billion over the next 5 years in the UK to build and maintain these huge data centres in the UK. What do you make of I don't know, that number, but also the fact that this is being built? Are we behind other countries? Are we getting ahead of the game? Is a new government making any difference to these kind of decisions?
I mean, apparently there are over 10,000 data centres worldwide, but half of them at least are in the US. So pretty much everyone's behind the US and trying to catch up, and the UK is in that place as well. But there's an adage in investing that if there's a gold rush, you want to be the person selling picks and shovels, and data centres are really the picks and shovels of the AI revolution. So, you know, everyone wants to get onto that conveyor belt.
I spoke to Phil LeBrun, Director of Enterprise Strategy at Amazon Web Services, which is the division at Amazon that is putting this money in, about this on the Wake Up to Money podcast on BBC Sounds. We discussed the investment. I asked him about the Competition Authority's investigations as well into the data centre industry at the moment, the dominance of the likes of Amazon and Microsoft.
There's a lot of competition in this space, and you know, I'm proud to say AWS has reduced prices 134 times since we started in 2006. So we'll continue to work with the CMA on this, but you know, our primary focus is to help our customers succeed in their desire to grow their businesses and innovate on behalf of their customers.
You can hear more of that on BBC Sounds. Altaf, just briefly, the oil price dipped below $70 a barrel yesterday, lowest for nearly 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about supply and demand. And I think here it's a question of slowing demand. And that's because growth is slowing, economies are slowing, especially China. And outside of China, you know, the aggressive hikes in interest rates have deliberately put a crimper on growth as well. So I think it's more about demand than anything. Clearly, there are still big risks out there. And if we see an escalation of a conflict in the Middle East, for example, or Russia-Ukraine, we could see the oil price spike back up.
Altaf, thanks so much. Altaf Kassam there from State Street Global Advisors. You may well have noticed we didn't get to that metals expert because we had technical issues trying to get them on the line. We'll try and bring you more on that Tata investment that the government will be, or money that will be going towards Tata and those job cuts a little later on.
Sean, thanks very much. We look forward to that. Hopefully we can make it work. It is 29 minutes past six. Here's Simon Mundy with the Sports News. Morning, Simon.
A very good morning to you. On the occasion of his 100th international cap, England captain Harry Kane scored both of England's goals to secure a 2-0 win over Finland in football's Nations League at Wembley. Wearing golden boots to mark his centenary of England appearances, Kane drove home the 67th and 68th goals of his international career.
Here is Kane once again.
To have a little nutmeg and then strike it the way I did was right up there, to be honest.
Kane with a shot, and Harry Kane on this special night lashes the ball past Radetzky.
Both of them will go down as a couple of my favourites for sure.
Kane sweeps it in for 2-0, and now not only has he scored one on his big night, he's doubled it.
Elsewhere in the group, the Republic of Ireland were beaten 2-0 by Greece in Dublin. Cricket and England have dropped batter Dan Lawrence for the tour of Pakistan and included the uncapped pair Jordan Cox and Brydon Carr in a 17-man squad. Captain Ben Stokes returns for the three tests in October after missing the 2-1 series win against Sri Lanka with a hamstring injury. Opener Zach Crawley is also back. Before that, England men begin a busy September of white ball cricket tonight to start an 8-match series against Australia, and England's women play Ireland in the third and final one-day international of the series this morning in Belfast. Here is our cricket reporter Henry Moran.
There's always a sense of additional intrigue when England face Australia, regardless of the format, and the 8 matches that complete the international summer, 3 T20s and 5 ODIs, will be a really interesting barometer of where England's white ball game is at. Brendan McCullum takes over as head coach in the new year, Champions Trophy first on the agenda, but make no mistake, he'll be keeping an eye from afar on who performs well in the coming weeks. Some talk that England have lost their sparkle in the shorter format. Who better to find it against than the old enemy? Over in Belfast, England's women are fresh from their biggest ever ODI win, 275 runs the margin of victory against Ireland in the second game of a 3-match series that concludes today. They lead that series by 2-0 and will be confident of completing a series clean sweep.
And in tennis, Great Britain's Davis Cup captain Leon Smith says he'll make a decision this morning on whether or not US Open semi-finalist Jack Draper will play in the tie against Finland a little later. Draper, who is trying to get fit after suffering a niggle in his defeat to Jannik Sinner, practiced yesterday afternoon in Manchester, and we will be hearing from the veteran Brit Dan Evans ahead of today's Davis Cup opening tie a little later in the programme.
Simon, thank you.
It's been a summer of spectacular concerts from the BBC Proms, with stunning performances and unique collaborations. Culminating in the world's biggest classical music party. The last night of the Proms. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
Oh, there you go, sounding good. It is 28 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. A very good morning to you. And now we have a summary of the news from Caroline Nichols.
Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have faced each other in the only scheduled televised debate of the US presidential election. At the event in Pennsylvania, the pair began with a handshake before trading blows on immigration, abortion and the economy. Ms. Harris repeatedly appealed directly to the American public and accused the former president of only looking after the rich. She said Mr. Trump would be manipulated by dictators if he returned to the White House. He called her a Marxist and said she had no economic plans. Mr. Trump repeatedly brought the subject back to immigration and said the vice president's administration had allowed millions of people to enter the country illegally. Moments after the broadcast finished, Kamala Harris was boosted by an endorsement from the hugely influential and popular singer Taylor Swift. Writing on Instagram, Swift said the Democratic candidate fought for the rights and causes she believed in. The Foreign Secretary David Lammy is visiting Ukraine to demonstrate his support for the country in its fight against Russia. He's travelling with his US counterpart, Antony Blinken. The pair will discuss President Zelensky's requests to be given permission to use British and American long-range missiles against targets in Russia. The government will introduce the Renters' Rights Bill to Parliament today. It seeks to ban no-fault evictions, which housing campaigners say are a key cause of homelessness. The legislation was a Conservative manifesto pledge in 2019, but was never passed. Under Labour's plans, tenants will also be given the right to own a pet and a timescale introduced on how quickly private landlords must undertake repairs. The National Farmers Union is warning that its goal to make UK farming net zero by 2040 is in doubt because of a lack of investment in climate-friendly agriculture. The NFU wants the new government to increase the farming budget from £3.5 billion to £5.6 billion. The government says it's still committed to reducing emissions and protecting food security. Amazon has announced plans to invest £8 billion in the UK over the next 5 years to build and maintain large data centres. The firm says this will eventually support 14,000 jobs. The government has welcomed the plans.
Thank you. It is 26 minutes to seven. Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump. It was billed as a moment that could change the entire campaign for the presidency. Let's talk to Gary O'Donoghue, our senior North America correspondent, who was watching it all. And she came, didn't she, Gary, with a plan to annoy him, which seemed to work.
She really did get under his skin on repeated occasions, and he looked flustered and he looked irritated at times, and I think perhaps an indication of his frustration came shortly after the debate when, lo and behold, while we were all in the spin room carrying on talking to people and doing our job, he appeared. And he appeared in here for about 15 minutes, surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of journalists, as you can imagine. And I think, you know, as you know, these events, the spin room is really designed for your surrogates to come and gloss your case and iron out any problems you created. When the candidate appears in the spin room, you've generally speaking got a problem.
There were quite a few opportunities, weren't there, for Kamala Harris to make clear why she has changed her mind on so many key issues in this election. And it's fair to say, isn't she, that she didn't seize the opportunity to do that and she wasn't really pressed.
She didn't. Fracking is the obvious one that comes to mind, which is something she's come under a lot of pressure over, questions of funding the police, etc. The other thing I think will be even more concerning to some of her supporters is that on the economy, which of course is right at the top of the agenda for all voters, you know, she perhaps didn't set out enough about her plans for making life a bit easier for people who are feeling a cost of living crisis and putting some daylight between her and Joe Biden, because she has to walk this tightrope, doesn't she, between slightly owning the past but also slightly, you know, distancing herself from the past. So I think they will be a little disappointed about that. But some of this early polling that the networks do, this sort of instant polling, and, you know, you can debate how useful that is, does seem to suggest that she may have made some inroads among those independent voters. And it's, you know, it's worth reiterating that the way the American system works is that it's going to be decided in six or seven states, and it's going to be decided by about 200,000 people out of a country of 330 million. So the actual target audience, despite the fact tens of millions are watching, is pretty small. And so if you're making waves amongst them, then you're doing a job.
Gary Donoghue, thank you.
It's 23 minutes to seven. After a dramatic day in the Commons, which saw 52 Labour MPs, including seven ministers, not taking part in a vote designed to block government plans to cut winter fuel payments to pensioners, the government prevailed. Millions of pensioners will lose winter fuel payments this year. Only one Labour MP, John Trickett, voted against the government on what he said was a matter of life and death for his constituents. How is the mood in the government and the Labour Party this morning then? Henry Zeffman, chief political correspondent, is here. Tell us.
Well, it's still quite hard, Emma, to work out how many Labour MPs actually wanted to register an abstention here. It's the problem in the House of Commons with interpreting absences. So, for example, I think seven or eight ministers weren't there for the vote yesterday, but they'll have been away on official government business. If they'd been there, they absolutely would have voted with the government line. Government saying, actually, they reckon only 12 of those who who didn't vote yesterday, those Labour MPs who didn't vote yesterday, were unauthorised absences. But we're not sure of that. We've, you know, looked at the list and we've found at least 20 who've either vocally, publicly said they oppose what the government's doing here or have told us that they weren't there because they wanted to register their discontent. So I think if you take a step back here, it is notable that Keir Starmer and his Chancellor Rachel Rees had to do a lot of work concertedly to persuade their own MPs to back something that they want to persuade the public of, that this was a necessary move in fiscally straitened times. On the other hand, this was a controversial decision with big popular discontent from Labour MPs, and it still passed with a majority of 120. That's a reminder of Keir Starmer's vast parliamentary strength.
It is indeed. But just briefly, the government is also set to introduce a bill in the Commons today which will ban landlords potentially for evicting tenants without reason.
That's right. And if this sounds familiar, that's because it is. This is something that the Conservatives said they were going to do for 5 years, but never could quite manage, mostly because of opposition from Conservative backbenchers. The Labour Party much more united on this, and so it will happen. Big items in this bill: no-fault evictions, where a landlord can evict a tenant essentially whenever they like with 6 weeks or maybe 2 months' notice. Those would be banned. Other things included in this bill: ban on rental bidding wars, so forcing landlords to publish an asking rent for the property, and limiting rent rises to once a year.
As you say, more united on that front. Henry Sefman, Chief Political Correspondent, thanks for putting us in the picture.
20 to 7 is the time. The National Audit Office is expressing concern about the impact the training of Ukrainian troops is having on our own armed forces. Frank Gardner's our security correspondent. What are they telling us, Frank?
Yeah, so they've done what they call an investigation. It's not a kind of how much bang for your buck do you get. They've just simply published this morning an extensive investigation into the training and supply of munitions that Britain does for Ukraine. And it's broadly positive. I mean, Britain has trained more than 42,000 Ukrainians who have passed through basic infantry training. The vast majority say they benefited from it. It's made them more prepared for war. But it is having an impact on UK training. And they found that, there are a limited number of training areas in Britain. And in the last year, there have been 8 more refusals for British Army training requests because those areas are already taken up by Ukrainian training. It's something called Operation Interflex, which is the entire effort to train Ukrainian troops. So this is where, you know, officers will say, right, I need to train my battalion. We'll put in a bid to put them on this bit of Salisbury Plain or that bit of Thetford in Norfolk. And they're told, sorry, that's already booked for the Ukrainians. So that's 8 times more than in the previous year. We did put these questions to the MOD. The other big concern, which they have partly addressed, is over drones. So you'll have noticed, Nick, that, you know, one of the big aspects of the war in Ukraine is that drones, particularly something called FPV, first-person view drones, where somebody is sitting in a trench, in a bunker, with goggles on, directing this drone at Russian troops, and the Russians are doing the same. There isn't really enough of that over here in the UK. Now, the MOD is saying that they do a bit of it, and they're expanding it, but some Ukrainians have complained that the training is not entirely relevant because it doesn't include enough of drones.
Frank Gardner, thank you.
Let's just have a look then at the papers, 18 minutes to 7. It's a couple of medical stories actually just bring your attention to. On the front page of the Times, it says heavy snorers could be prescribed a daily pill that have been found to halve symptoms and help sufferers sleep soundly through the night. And experts hope the drug called Sulfiem, I hope I've got that right, could provide the first effective medical treatment for millions of snorers, reducing the risk of heart complications and providing relief for long-suffering partners. And just another one here on pain, which I thought was fascinating, that scientists have found people who underwent a physically painful ordeal felt less discomfort when a dog was nearby. So the idea of having a dog with you when you're about to go through something difficult that may cause pain has been proven to be helpful.
No surprise to dog owners. President Biden is poised to lift the Ukraine missile ban, according to The Telegraph and indeed The Times as well. In fact, it's the lead story for both of them. Joe Biden poised to lift that ban, the ban on British Storm Shadow missiles being fired into Russia by Ukraine. He's considering changing policy, The Telegraph says, after it emerged that Iran was arming Russia with ballistic missiles. missiles that could be used in Ukraine within weeks. And one other thing on the front pages of more of the tabloids, but certainly in a lot of the papers as well, those prisoners celebrating after getting released early. And the headline in the Mail is, "Who voted for all of this?" And at 17 minutes to 7, our main headline, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have taken part in an often ill-tempered presidential debate. The pair exchanged personal attacks and clashed on issues such as immigration, the Ukraine war and abortion.
Bringing our attention back to UK politics, at 16 minutes to 7, millions of pensioners will not get help with their energy bills after MPs backed the government's plan to cut winter fuel payments. A Conservative attempt to block the change failed in spite of a rebellion by Labour backbenchers. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
The result was never really in doubt.
The ayes to the right, 228. Ooh. The noes to the left, 348.
As expected, the government saw off a Conservative attempt to block changes to the rules on winter fuel payments by a majority of 120 votes. A healthy winning margin, but still a drop in support. Labour has a working Commons majority of 167. Opening the debate, the Conservative Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary Mel Stride sought to play on the well-advertised unhappiness of many Labour MPs about the changes, as he urged them to look to their consciences.
You know in your heart that these measures are wrong. You know in your heart that you have, the party opposite, has broken their promises, and that these measures are going to lead to untold hardship for millions of elderly and vulnerable people right up and down this country. You now have an opportunity to join with us and put a stop to it.
Yeah. But a Labour MP, Anna Dixon, blamed the former Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and the Conservative government for the situation.
They were pursuing a scorched earth policy, the NHS running on empty, costs of housing, asylum seekers skyrocketing, and hollow promises on capital projects across the country, including in my own constituency.
On this, at least, there was some cross-party agreement. For the Liberal Democrats, Wendy Chamberlain said years of Conservative mismanagement had left the public finances in crisis.
But this cut is simply wrong. It is wrong to strip support from many of the poorest pensioners, just as energy bills are set to rise again. It is wrong to force vulnerable elderly people to make that choice between heating and eating this winter. And it is the wrong answer to the challenges that we face.
A Conservative former Cabinet Minister, Esther McVeigh, accused Labour of cynical political calculation.
This is good old-fashioned pork barrel politics, taking money away from the people that the Chancellor thinks don't vote Labour, like pensioners, to hand to people that they think do vote Labour, train drivers, public sector workers.
The Labour MP, Rachel Maskell, had pushed for ministers to think again. She told the Commons she couldn't vote for the changes.
We're getting the letters coming in. We're looking at the figures that our constituents have to look at every single day, and they're scared. And they're telling us they're frightened because they won't switch the switch, because they know if they do, they will have bills that they cannot pay. And we need to protect those very vulnerable people.
She abstained in the vote. This was Sir Keir Starmer's second parliamentary rebellion since becoming Prime Minister. In July, seven Labour MPs had the whip suspended for 6 months after they voted against the government in protest at rules which prevent almost all parents from claiming universal credit or child tax credit if they have more than two children. One of those who now sits as an independent, the former Labour Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, said the change to winter fuel payments would place a burden on poor people.
I just hope people learn the lesson as we move towards this budget, not to put us in this position again, where we take a decision which is based upon, I believe, misjudgment, and certainly flies against everything I believe in as a Labour MP about tackling inequality and poverty within our society. I was not elected to impoverish my constituents and put them in this hardship.
Winding up the debate, the Work and Pensions Secretary, Liz Kendall, said it had been a difficult decision to means-test winter fuel payments. She accused the Conservatives of shying away from their responsibilities when they were in government.
We were elected
united on a platform to deliver economic stability, rebuild the country and make the changes our country needs. Making this country better and giving it its future back. Pensioners deserve better than the faux outrage of members opposite.
The changes are due to become law in the next few days, but not before members of the House of Lords debate and vote on the proposals later today.
And that was Sean Curran on Yesterday in Parliament. Brings us to 12 minutes to 7. The Social Mobility Commission reports today on the state of the nation in 2024. It is not all bad news, though there is plenty of work, it seems, still to be done. And Alan Francis is the chair of the commission and is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
The overview, first of all.
Well, just for context, our annual report is part of our statutory responsibility to report to Parliament on the broad trends around social mobility in the country. And so what we do is we record the kind of key big statistical trends that we can see, some of which are long-term, some of which are a bit shorter-term. And in the report that's published today, we have two parts. One is that building on our previous 2 years' work, where we've tried to consolidate and give really good quality data on social mobility, we update on that. And secondly, we try and build an index which can start to look at a really important theme around social mobility, which is geography.
Right. And when it comes to geography, it's fascinating, isn't it? There are parts of the country that you would expect have a problem. And in fact, we've talked about quite recently on the programme during the course of the exam results, the annual exam results coming out during the summer. And some places obviously doing better than others, and there being no obvious reason for that. But there are some parts of the country, the southwest of England included, where you wouldn't necessarily have expected there to be a problem, and there unquestionably is.
Well, I think our report has good news and challenging news in it. Some of the good news is around some of the improved access to higher skills and higher education. We can come and talk about that perhaps in a minute. But the geography, I think people know there are geographical patterns around opportunities. We saw that with A-level and GCSE results. And we know that in terms of some of the patterns around likelihood of somebody from one background becoming getting a professional job, for example. And we know that those geographical differences, although it's really important to say there are a range of factors which affect somebody's social mobility. Socioeconomic background is important. Gender, ethnicity, disability is important. But when we look at the geography, we do find that people from similar backgrounds, in terms of all those other characteristics, in different parts of the country, have quite different prospects.
Yeah.
So as you say, if you compare parts of the southwest with London, the home counties, or northeast, or other parts of the country, you can see quite big differences.
And interestingly, it's not necessarily about hardship, is it? Because there is, as you were saying, there's an ethnic side to this. And it's really fascinating that your report suggests that, for instance, children on free school meals who are from a Chinese background perform much better than the national average for non-free school meals children at the ages of 11 and 16. What's going on there? What is the role, do you think, of culture, which is essentially, I suppose, what we're talking about, in people being socially mobile?
That's such a fantastic question, and one which I think is very difficult to answer. And there's reams of academic literature, as you can imagine, on that. But what it does stand out for us that there is no simple one way of reading social mobility data, because the patterns are quite different with different groups. So we do find, for example, Chinese and Indian origin young people doing very, very well educationally. That doesn't always yet translate into outcomes in terms of professional jobs, but educationally they do extremely well, despite sometimes coming from quite poor circumstances. So these are things that we need to explore more and understand better in order to understand why those exceptions to the rule apply, because in other respects we find a broader pattern around geography where particularly the former industrial towns, the seaside towns, the rural areas, places where the economy is very flat and where there's big disparities regionally, we tend to find there's a pattern there of low attainment over generations.
Okay. Well, people, they want to read the report, I think it comes out at 11 o'clock this morning. Alan Francis, Chair of the Social Mobility Commission. Thank you very much.
7 minutes to 7. One of the first acts of the new government and the Health Secretary was to commission an independent investigation into the performance of the NHS just days after winning power. Wes Streeting said in July that the review would be aimed at diagnosing the problem so ministers could write the prescription. That review by a world-renowned surgeon and independent peer, Lord Darzi, is coming out tomorrow. What should we expect? Thea Stein, who's the chief executive of the Nuffield Trust, an independent health think tank, is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you expect to be one of the biggest observations and calls for action?
Well, I expect the Darzi report to pull together a lot of the data, a lot of the information that is could be in the public domain and certainly is well known to the Department of Health, to NHS England, and to lay out the scale of the challenge that faces the NHS. I think what I'm concerned about is that we may not get a laying out of the issues that face social care or the issues that face public health. And that could mean that we get a partial diagnosis, to use the phrases that the government themselves has used, and that could lead to a partial treatment or prescription.
Why do you think that?
Well, because the NHS doesn't exist in a bubble. The NHS exists in relationship to many other services and many other things that are going on. We all know, and I'm sure you've discussed many times on your programme, that things that are going on in social care leads to people sometimes going into hospital when they could have been prevented or staying in hospital longer than they need. We know that some of the failures in public health, some of the ways in which we can't put the money we need into health visiting, into housing, into making sure that houses are clean and damp free, will lead to children coming to hospital with, for example, respiratory disease. I mean, there are so many ways in which what the NHS deals with and the NHS is struggling with is the result of many other things that happen out with the NHS as well.
But there are, I think that's a, you know, and no one probably could disagree that that's a valid concern. It's a valid argument. We'll wait to see how this presents itself. We're also going to wait to see how the government looks at those issues in the round, or perhaps doesn't, and we need to hold them to account for that. But waiting times is chief amongst what some people
Absolutely.
Are going to flag here, and there will be the argument that that doesn't necessarily need to be analysed in terms of what you've just said.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Although there are variations according to deprivation, etc. But yes, what we'll see is we've got 6.39 million people in this country who are on a waiting list for some procedure, and we will see that is significantly high. We know from the work we've done in the Nuffield that is bigger than comparable countries. And what I'd be hoping to see is that there's some understanding of the structural vulnerabilities which left the NHS so vulnerable to the rising of those waiting lists during the pandemic, although they were rising before that, and some diagnosis and prescription, which looks at everything from the buildings that care takes place in, the amount of diagnostic equipment we've got, the support for staff, etc. So I would certainly expect to see and hope a focus on that. I would also hope to see a focus on GP practices in primary care, because we know that there are two areas the public are most concerned about that came through in the British Social Attitude Survey. It is waiting times in hospitals and his access and continuity of care within GP practices.
And for you, it's not just about more money then? That sounds about structural reform.
No, sorry, if I said it, that made it sound like structural reform, not moving the pieces around on the board, but the buildings. We know that some of the issues
yes,
get in the way
but
of
I
working
meant for the solution for that, is that more money, or is this in conjunction with reorganising?
It'll be a variety of things. Without a doubt, the NHS has a lower proportion of funding than many other comparable countries, and that's been put out there many, many times.
I suppose Thea, at a time when we're hearing from the government repeatedly that difficult decisions have to be made, it's going to be interesting to see what room there is for manoeuvre on this. Thank you for the primer, Thea Stein, CEO of the Nuffield Trust. What are your experiences right now of the NHS? We'd very much like to hear from you this morning ahead of that major independent review out tomorrow. Maybe you've been waiting for an operation, or you've had to wait with a parent or a loved one in A&E recently. Do email us. The address is today@bbc.co.uk. It'd be great to have your, and I'm sure they're not great, but if you are waiting, it'd be really helpful to have your experiences. You can contact us on WhatsApp just so we can get a picture of this. The number is 0330 123 4346. That's 0330 123 4346. Either type a message or send us a short voice note by pressing the microphone icon.
To the weather, Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Justin. Well, a real autumnal feel to the weather today. We've got cold air coming in from the northwest, so blustery showers, some sunshine, and the showers are going to become more frequent into the afternoon. But let's start with where we've got the downpours this morning. So through parts of Wales, northwest England, southwest Scotland, northern Scotland and Northern Ireland. Some heavy showers first thing. We've even got the odd flash of lightning around as well. That's going to be the picture through the day. Those showers coming and going with those blustery winds. Could be some hail, some thunderstorms mixed in at times, and the showers even a little bit wintry over the highest ground of Scotland. Temperatures here around 10 to 13 degrees. For the rest of the UK, that's all of southern England, through the Midlands, eastern England, northeast England and eastern Scotland. It's chilly start, temperatures down in single figures. Some sunshine around through the morning hours, but by this afternoon, cloud builds to give some heavy showers and again a risk of some hail and thunderstorms. Overnight tonight, expect a chilly night as showers fade away. Temperatures could get down to 2 or 3 in the coldest spots. Sunshine and showers again tomorrow, but not as many as today, not quite as blustery. And then things turn a little bit quieter and drier into the end of the week.
Sarah, thank you very much. Coming up in the next hour, Donald Trump against Kamala Harris. What went on and what does it mean potentially for the polls and for the election?
All that coming out. You're listening to today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 11th of September. Good to have you with us. The headlines this morning. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have taken part in a combative US presidential debate, trading personal attacks and clashing on the economy, immigration and the Ukraine war. The foreign secretary and his US counterpart are going to Ukraine today to discuss President Zelensky's demand to use British and American long-range missiles against Russia. The government will introduce legislation today for the biggest shake-up of the rental market in England in 3 decades. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The two candidates to be President of the United States have traded barbs and accusations about immigration, abortion and the economy in the only scheduled televised debate of the campaign. The event in Philadelphia began with a handshake before Kamala Harris and Donald Trump went on to repeatedly accuse each other of lying. The vice president said Mr. Trump would offer tax cuts to billionaires, while the former president said Ms. Harris had turned the US into a failing country. Our North America editor Sarah Smith was watching the debate and sent this report.
A combative Kamala Harris clearly intended to try to rile Donald Trump, and she obviously succeeded in getting under his skin. He looked distinctly rattled as she said he was fired by millions of voters at the last election, that people leave his campaign rallies early because they get bored, and that he's disrespected on the world stage.
It is absolutely well known that these dictators and autocrats are rooting for you to be president again because they're so clear they can manipulate you with flattery and favors.
Unaccustomed to being on the defensive, Donald Trump stuck closely to his most familiar talking points, constantly referring to the high numbers of illegal migrants entering America, saying they're committing crimes, and even claiming, without evidence, that they're killing people's pets.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country.
You talk about extreme.
Afterwards, Donald Trump claimed this was his best debate yet, as he made a surprise appearance in the media center, just as the Harris campaign suggested doing another debate next month.
They immediately called for a second debate because they lost.
Kamala Harris's performance was far from flawless, but she obviously thinks she came out on top, which is why she wants to do it all again before Election Day.
Kamala Harris has received the backing of the hugely influential and popular singer Taylor Swift. In an Instagram statement posted 15 minutes after the debate ended, Swift called Ms. Harris a warrior. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Taylor Swift is one of the biggest celebrities in the world, and her more than 284 million Instagram followers include an intensely loyal band of young women, a key demographic in November's election. Speaking out to correct online misinformation, she said she'd be voting for Kamala Harris because she fights for the causes that need supporting. She went on to hail Ms. Harris's choice of running mate, saying Tim Walz had a record of standing up for women's rights. Accompanying the post is a picture of Taylor Swift holding her cat, Benjamin Button, and the statement is signed Childless Cat Lady, a reference to comments made by Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, about women who don't have children.
For more analysis on the presidential debate, you can listen to the latest Americast podcast. That's available now on BBC Sounds. The Foreign Secretary David Lammy and his US counterpart Antony Blinken are visiting Ukraine in a joint demonstration of support for the country. They'll discuss President Zelensky's demands to use long-range American and British missiles against targets in Russia. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale is travelling with the Foreign Secretary and sent this report.
This is the first joint overseas visit by a foreign secretary and US Secretary of State for more than a decade. A trip designed, officials say, to emphasise unified transatlantic support for Ukraine. But what leaders in Kyiv want is not so much support, but permission. The right to use American and British long-range missiles against targets in Russia. Chief among them, air bases used by Russian warplanes to launch devastating glide bombs against Ukraine. So far, that permission has been withheld amid US fears of Russian escalation. But Antony Blinken said he and Mr. Lammy wanted to hear directly from President Zelensky what he wants and report back to President Biden and Sir Keir Starmer, who are due to discuss the use of missiles in Washington on Friday. "We are listening intently to our Ukrainian partners," Mr. Blinken said, and US congressmen believe a change in American policy is imminent.
A number of Labour MPs have said they'll continue to press the government to offer support for pensioners who struggle to cope with losing their winter fuel payments. The government comfortably won a vote in the House of Commons on the issue yesterday, with only one Labour MP opposing the measures. But more than 50 either abstained or were absent. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
A number of Labour MPs have privately told the BBC they will continue to push the government to bring in measures to ease the impact of this policy. They said ideas such as discounted energy bills for the vulnerable or extending schemes to pay for the heating of those with health conditions made worse by the cold were essential. So far, there are no signs of support from ministers. Labour Party sources said last night only a dozen of their 52 MPs absent from the vote were not authorised. But BBC analysis shows at least 20 of those who did not vote had expressed opposition to the idea, suggesting many abstained on principle. For Sir Keir Starmer, it was the first parliamentary test of his government, as both he and the Chancellor warn of more tough decisions in the budget over tax, spending and welfare.
Figures which have just been published show that the UK economy did not grow in July. The Office for National Statistics said that services grew, but production and the construction sector both fell. The government will introduce a bill to Parliament today that'll see the biggest overhaul to England's rental market in more than three decades. The Renters' Rights Bill will ban so-called no-fault evictions, which campaigners say are a leading cause of homelessness. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
If the name of the bill sounds familiar, that's because it is. The previous Conservative government also had a renters' bill that similarly pledged to scrap no-fault evictions, whereby a landlord can remove a tenant simply because they want their property back. But despite being a Tory party manifesto pledge in 2019, the previous bill wasn't passed. Now the new government is promising to scrap no-fault evictions, as well as giving tenants other rights, including the right to keep a pet, to ban landlords from refusing tenants simply because they're on benefits, and to put a timescale on how quickly private landlords must undertake repairs.
The National Farmers Union is warning that its ambition to make UK farming net zero by 2040 is in doubt. The NFU says a lack of investment in climate-friendly agriculture schemes by the previous government has made that target much tougher to deliver. Here's our rural affairs correspondent, Malcolm Pryor.
Farming accounts for about 12% of the UK's total greenhouse gas emissions. 5 years ago, the NFU set a target to help farmers reach net zero by 2040. That's 10 years before the rest of the economy. But today, it says a lack of funding to support climate-friendly measures by the previous government means that aim has become, in its words, tricky to meet. Environmental campaigners have gone further. They say agriculture needs radical changes if emissions are to be cut. The NFU is now calling for the new government to up its total annual UK farming budget from £3.5 billion to £5.6. The government says it's still committed to reducing emissions in the farming sector, as well as protecting food security.
Amazon has announced it will invest £8 billion over the next 5 years to build and maintain massive data centres in the UK. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has welcomed the announcement, which comes as ministers are expected to confirm a £500 million grant for modernisation at Tata Steel's Port Talbot plant, which will result in job losses. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Amazon says its plans to invest in new data centres in the UK will ultimately support 14,000 jobs. The announcement comes on the same day. The government will confirm that nearly 3,000 jobs will soon go at the Port Talbot Steelworks in South Wales. The construction of new, greener electric furnaces will require far fewer workers than the carbon-intensive blast furnaces. The government insists that decarbonisation does not mean deindustrialisation and that greener versions of traditional industries and newer ones like Amazon's data centres will provide the jobs of the future.
Simon Jack reporting.
Thank you. 9 minutes past seven is the time. Kamala Harris stayed focused, stuck to her task, which it seems was to needle Donald Trump, to put him off his game, and not necessarily to answer any questions about her own changes of position down the years. In one exchange in the ABC News presidential debate, potentially the only debate between the two candidates before polling day, the subject she brought up was his rallies.
You will see during the course of his rallies, he talks about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. He will talk about windmills cause cancer. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom. And I will tell you, the one thing you will not hear him talk about is you.
First, let me respond as to the rallies. She said people start leaving. People don't go to her rallies. There's no reason to go. And the people that do go, she's busing them in and paying them to be there. And then showing them in a different light. So she can't talk about that. People don't leave my rallies.
Some of Donald Trump's own supporters were annoyed that their man did not manage to pin her down. But it is a fact that the race is still too close to call and that most Americans, the vast majority, have already made up their minds. Plus, it's worth remembering Hillary Clinton won 3 debates against Donald Trump in 2016 by general acclamation. But, of course, she still didn't win the election. Let us talk to James Kanagasuriam, who is the chief research officer at the polling data firm Focal Data and has himself spent quite a lot of time in the United States recently. James, good morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
Just before we get to your poll, and you've got an important poll out at the moment, do we know from polling evidence what it is people wanted to get from that debate last night?
I think people probably wanted clarity on the top two issues that the American public think that they want their leaders to solve, and they are the economy and immigration. And I think it was very interesting that the debate focused quite a lot on those issues. When it comes to the economy, I think there are two dynamics here at play. The first is people's concerns over inflation and the cost of living, which is by far and away the most salient issue in American politics. 50% of people choose it as their top issue. And the second is immigration. And I think it was really interesting that the flashpoints of last night's debate were really on the economy. I think that's where Trump was probably at his strongest. But I also thought it was really interesting that Harris was deploying quite an unusual set of policies, you would think, for the Democrats, which was around criticising a Trump sales tax, which is effectively his tariff plan, calling for tax cuts and talking about the benefits of small business. I mean, for British listeners, that would be quite strange to hear, I think, the party of the left argue for those things. So here you can see a tension between the Democrats calling for a more competitive, open economy, but then the Republicans there are really focusing on the fact that the cost of living hasn't been great and that inflation is very high.
And there's no doubt, is there, from the polling, that immigration, particularly illegal immigration, is a real vulnerability for Kamala Harris, particularly as she's had some connection with policy over the southern border during her time as vice president in the Biden administration, when many, many people, millions of people, have come into America illegally. And yet he ended up talking, didn't he, about whether people in a certain city had been, immigrants had been eating people's pets. And I mean, it just felt unfocused, to put it mildly.
I think that's right. So the immigration is the second most important issue to Americans. And in the battleground swing states, so however you want to define that, kind of Arizona, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, you know, there's about six or seven clutch of them. It's the second most important issue, but Trump leads Harris 72 points on that issue. And the lead is even bigger in Arizona. So it's a real acute weakness for the Democrats. I think they know this. I think that clearly Trump knows this, but he, you know, his slightly bizarre turn talking about cats and dogs, I think he was referencing a small city in Ohio, was to take structurally something that most Americans would agree with him and turn it into something quite rambling and quite diffuse. And I just, think in general that was a theme.
Just a final thought, James, your own polling. You've done a large-scale poll, haven't you, which suggests what about the potential outcome?
Well, I think at the minute it's suggesting that it's on a knife edge and there's probably only going to be around 50 to 60,000 votes between the two candidates come the election. Currently, we're forecasting a very, very narrow Trump win. And we see him taking Pennsylvania, which is the key swing state, by barely 1.5 points. Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Wisconsin and Georgia are all very, very, very marginal. So at the minute, we think it's basically all to play for. But Harris is behind. She's only 1.5 points ahead in the popular vote. And because of the electoral college system, I think she needs to be around 3 to 4. So my view is that broadly she's slightly behind.
James Kanagasuren, Chief Research Officer for Focal Data. Thank you very much.
14 minutes past seven. The government is set to introduce a bill in the Commons today which will ban landlords from evicting tenants without a reason. Ministers are expected to bring the Renters' Rights Bill for its first reading, and the draft law, which will apply in England, will also give tenants the right to request a pet. A ban on no-fault evictions, a removal of those Section 21 notices, has long been promised but repeatedly delayed, with the previous Conservative government running out of time. The bill will be debated later in the autumn. Let's have a listen to what's happened to Sandra, who says she's been evicted 10 times under a Section 21 notice, and she's been told by her current landlord to move out by next week.
We've had so many homes, it's just ridiculous. Never got a place that you can properly call home. But you're just never certain how long you're going to be there. To these landlords, you know, we just don't matter. They don't care. They don't look at you as people. They just go, oh, we can get more money from that flat if we get you out, so off you go. Because at the moment, we're having great trouble trying to find somewhere else. So at the moment, we simply don't have a home and we don't really know what's going to happen to us.
Sandra there. Listening to that, Ben Beadle, Chief Executive of the National Residential Landlords Association. It's time to make giving tenants more security a priority, isn't it?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, what we have seen for the past 5 years is a sector that's been riddled with uncertainty. And we have renters that need greater security. And obviously, you know, my sympathies to Sandra is having a rotten time in finding a property. But whilst this will bring forward greater regulation, what it won't do is bring forward additional homes that we so desperately need, either in the social or the rented sector.
I know,
and
but
we do run the risk.
I was going to say the poor behaviour of some landlords has to be brought in to check. I mean, what have you seen of that? What's driving that?
Well, I think that there's a lack of enforcement for starters. Local authorities have been absolutely decimated in the past decade with regards to funding. And that simply means that you have the vast, vast majority of landlords doing a really good job. And I would say that landlords do care about their tenants. They have great satisfaction rates in the private rented sector, much higher than the social sector. But of course, we still have some challenges around the edges. And what we don't want to do is to effectively drive the good landlords out and to leave the good, the bad landlords behind. And I think we do need to see, whatever these changes are going to look like, a greater investment in enforcement so that everybody has confidence.
Sorry, and when you mean enforcement, you mean the ability to remove difficult tenants?
No, I mean, well, yes, but I also mean the ability to weed out rogue and criminal landlords that bring the sector into
dispute. So both sides of that. I mean, there's also a call with this bill for the limits to rent increases in tenancies. Otherwise, there's a fear that unaffordable rent rises will become another form of no-fault evictions. As the CEO of the National Residential Landlords Association, where do you stand on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, tenants can already challenge unfair rent increases through the first tier tribunal. So this isn't anything new. I guess perhaps renters don't know that this exists or their rights on this. I've no issue with tenants having access to justice, but the thing is, you know, the fewer homes that you have, the more demand that you have. We have on average 17 tenants applying to rent one property. And so until we actually deal with the core issue of a lack of supply in the sector, that's not going to get better through these changes. In some respects, it may well get worse because it may force good landlords out of the sector.
No, it's just, you know, when you say people can challenge, they may know, but they may not have the time, the capacity, the funds themselves to do that. And they feel that they can't challenge.
Well, I understand that with Section 21 hanging over people's heads where landlords don't need to give a reason, I understand that that is an issue. And I think that I fully understand why the government are removing that. I think what I would say, though, is that we need to not push the needle too far. It's whilst it's unreasonable for landlords to issue Section 21s without a decent reason, I would argue that if you've got a good tenant, you will want to keep them in the property. So this shouldn't be a significant change for landlords, and landlords would just want the alternative to be effective for dealing with things like antisocial behaviour, rent arrears and selling the property.
Well, people have said this will be the biggest change in three decades. So it will be interesting to see what gets through and what doesn't. It's at the beginning of the process again. Ben Beadle, Chief Executive of the National Residential Landlords Association, thank you.
19 minutes past seven. Data just out seem to show that the economy failed to grow in July. Sean has more on that. Hello again, Sean.
Hi, Justin. Yeah, so in the month of July, no growth in the economy. There were actually some expectations of some growth. So this is coming below that. There was no growth in June either. So it means when we tot up the value of the goods we made, things we built, services we provided, that didn't increase at all over those 2 months. There's always a bit of a caveat with this monthly data jumping around a bit and being volatile as it gets revised in later times. But to help extract some of the trends and reasons beneath the numbers, I've got Liz McEwen, Director of Economic Statistics at the Office for National Statistics. Morning, Liz.
Good morning, Sean.
Is this an economy stalling?
Well, what we've seen this month is another month of no growth. But you're quite right. We should also look at the slightly broader picture. And when we do that, we see that the economy grew by 0.5% over the 3 months to July. And that was driven by pretty broad-based strength in services. We can also look at the picture for 2024 as a whole and how we've started this year. And we've actually seen average growth of 0.2% per month in the first 7 months of the year. And if we compare to what we are seeing across the whole of 2023, where we averaged no growth per month across 2023, we can see that we have had that more positive start to the year in 2024.
Right. And when we drill down a little bit into what happened in July, are there things there that continued a trend that jump out for you?
Yeah, so that broad-based strength in services that we saw in the 3 months to July also continued in July itself. And so we saw positive services growth in July, offset by weaker manufacturing and construction figures. So within services, a good month for computer programmers, also health contributed. What we were seeing in health, you may remember the junior doctors strike, and there were 4 days of that in June and 1 day in July. And so that contributed to more activity in July than June.
Right. So do you start to see if the strikes become less frequent, the economy grow more because of that?
So you certainly see strikes contributing to the GDP figures. More broadly, looking at some of the services activity in July, we obviously, and you might remember back, it was a good month for sports. We had the Euros and the Olympics. And some businesses were telling us that was positively impacting their output that month.
And how does this stuff tally with the jobs market data that I was talking about this time yesterday morning? Unemployment down, you know, wages still growing at sort of 4 or 5% overall.
Yeah, some interesting things that we were seeing in the labour market figures yesterday. One of the things that I would draw attention to there is we've seen actually what I'd almost say was a normalisation of some of the economic data there. So we've got vacancies. They've been falling from a continuously for 26 months, but they're heading back towards the levels that we are typically seeing before the pandemic.
Right.
And we've also seen the same trend in earnings growth. It's beginning to slow and return to more typical levels.
Liz, thank you. Liz McEwen, Director of Economic Statistics at the ONS. So in July, no growth in the economy, but a good month for computer programmers by the sounds of it. So I hope they had a good time.
There you go. Sean, thanks very much for that. 22 minutes past seven. You may remember in July, in fact, it happened to be broadcast on the day of the general election, my conversation with Simon Bowis, the aid worker, whose words about dying and living inspired so many, going viral after he started writing about his terminal cancer diagnosis in his local newspaper, the Jersey Evening Post. So many of you got in touch after hearing our conversation in what turned out to be Simon's last broadcast interview.
I might be optimistic and happy and joyful, but I don't want anyone to feel that they're doing it wrong. You know, there really is no right way to approach the grave. And I'm conscious of how lucky I am in the perspective that I now have. But I think there are a few things in the book that might perhaps help. I talk about regrets and regrets for things not done. I talk about a bit about how I think one can cultivate a sense of gratitude, even towards the end. For me, that's been so helpful. There's so much to be thankful for. And the way I was looking at it was thinking, well, if I won £92 million on the Euro Millions jackpot, and then a few hours later discovered that I had to share the winning ticket and it was only £46 million, it would be pretty churlish to start complaining about that. I also talk a bit about one of the things that people in my situation are sent and have a lot of are sort of miracle cures and new scientific treatments, impossible stories of people going into remission at the last minute. And I know that these are terribly tempting, and it's also, I know, very well-meaning of people to send them, but for me, I've actually found that clutching at straws and that hope in the end has actually been antithetical to accepting it all. And also in the book, I include a bit about how other people can deal with people with cancer or who are dying, because so many of us get it wrong. And I have done so many times myself, you know, not just turning up unannounced, which is awful, but saying the wrong thing, or indeed sending the latest scientific treatment as if you're kind of implying that someone hasn't looked into all of these things. The best advice for other people, of course, is just to get in contact. And that's what we need the most, just to know that other people are thinking of us.
I think that's really important. And I do think it will be helpful. I think it will be strange, though, to perhaps reflect on if the fact that this book is going to come out later in the year and you won't be here.
No, I won't. But it's given me so much pleasure. The main thing is that the response to the articles, which went so viral, and that really gave me a sense that actually perhaps some of these things can be helpful and comforting. And again, not just to those imminently facing their own extinction, but to other people around them, or just to other people who might want to sort of take a step back and think about their own perspective. So it's a lovely thing to be able to do in my last couple of weeks, just to know that this little book will be out there. And I very much hope it's going to help people. And it also brings me great pleasure because, you know, I spent my life as an aid worker working in lots of developing countries, and I've benefited so much from palliative care. But I'm very conscious that we're terribly lucky in the West to have that. Whereas if you live in Sierra Leone or Rwanda, it's probably out of reach. So the profits from the book, or a substantial proportion of the royalties, are going to go to two palliative care charities. So it gives me huge pleasure to think that if there's any money to be made, it's going to benefit those who currently don't benefit from what I've had so much from.
Simon Bowis speaking on the programme in July, and he died 11 days after that interview was broadcast, aged 47. Tributes were paid to him around the world, and as he and I discussed, you just heard, he knew he wouldn't be here with What's Happening Tomorrow, the publication of his book, A Beginner's Guide to Dying. But his wife, Aurélie Boas, has taken on that task, talking about her husband's legacy, and you'll be able to hear her first broadcast interview just after 8 o'clock.
Time now, 27 minutes past 7, to the sport, and Simon.
Thank you. On the night of his 100th cap, England captain Harry Kane took centre stage. He scored two superbly taken goals to give England a 2-0 win over Finland in the UEFA Nations League at Wembley.
Kane with a shot! And Harry Kane, on this special night, lashes the ball past Radetzky.
Here's Madueke now into the air. Kane with a right foot shot! Kane sweeps it in for 2-0! Both England goals from the captain.
And we can now speak to the man whose dulcet tones you just heard, our football correspondent, John Murray. Good morning, John.
Yes, good morning, Simon.
Harry Kane went to Wembley with something of a point to prove, having had a few question his contribution, for example, in the Euros, but he turned up in those sparkly golden boots and rose to the occasion.
Yes, golden boots with the Midas touch. I would describe him as the man for all seasons, Harry Kane. And yes, there were questions about the way that he played in Germany and the fact that he was seen to be labouring. But, you know, he rarely misses out when it comes to the big occasion. And I think what is most striking about him is his hunger for goals. He can be quite modest, Harry Kane, when you talk to him. But let me tell you, he has a single-minded determination. He is 31 years old now, but there's no sign from him of letting up, hence the talk of him beating Peter Shilton's England men's appearance record of 125 and also pushing up towards scoring 100 goals for England.
And two wins in two for England's new interim manager Lee Carsley as well. The headline on the BBC Sport website reads, "Carsley has put his stamp on England, job feels like his to lose." What is the case for and against handing him the role on a full-time basis?
Well, I've interviewed him five times now over the past fortnight, and you know, he says he's been told he'll be in charge for all six matches that England have this autumn. I have to say, I do find it most unusual. We're talking about a man who's never managed in the Premier League and had never played or coached at Wembley until last night. He was telling us last night after the match he's felt he's been out of his comfort zone over the course of the past week. And yes, they've played limited opponents in Ireland and Finland, but his team has produced the kind of performances in the main, and I think he's been very shrewd to underline his coaching credentials. He's not Gareth Southgate, he never will be, but Lee Carsley is putting the emphasis on what he is best at.
And while it was clearly Harry Kane's night, Trent Alexander-Arnold also played a huge role. How impressed were you with him?
Yeah, very influential. He's been involved in all four goals that England has scored under Lee Carsley in these two matches. Whether he's moved ahead of Kyle Walker in the pecking order, I'm not sure. Kyle Walker is 34, was not selected in this squad. Lee Carsley says he still has a big future, but I'll be looking when Lee Carsley names his next squad next month to see if Kyle Walker's name is there.
John Murray, thank you very much. Elsewhere, just a couple of cricket lines. And England have dropped batter Dan Lawrence for the tour of Pakistan and included the uncapped pair Jordan Cox and Brydon Carse in a 17-man squad. And captain Ben Stokes returns for the three tests in October after missing the 2-1 series win against Sri Lanka with a hamstring injury, as does opener Zach Crawley.
Thanks very much, Simon. Tonight on Radio 4, a new series of piercing satire.
And now to dog fingers.
Listen up. It's the return of The Skewer.
There's been a lot of scrambling behind the scenes.
Multiple award-winning comedy on BBC Radio 4.
The US Secretary of State is urging anyone who owns a zombie to hand it in.
The biggest stories as heard inside the head of John Holmes.
There is also a set of ghosts arriving
and the atmosphere is electric.
Remixed, regurgitated and spat back out.
If you deep fry pretty much anything, it's going to taste good.
The Skewer returns to Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
What does this mean?
Don't fall off.
Oh dear.
Tonight at 11:15.
To the weather, which is going to be cool and breezy for most of us. Mixture of sunny spells and scattered showers. Those showers heavy at times. The risk of thunder locally.
In the next half an hour, coming up on this programme, after an Australian proposal to simply ban social media for children, We're going to discuss whether it could actually work and the highlights from that fiery US presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. It is 28 minutes to 8. Let's have the news from Caroline Nichols.
The US presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have faced each other in what could be the only head-to-head debate of the election. During increasingly ill-tempered exchanges, the pair focused on immigration, abortion and the economy. Mr. Trump portrayed Kamala Harris as a Marxist with no economic plans. He repeatedly returned to the issue of immigration, saying millions of people had entered the country illegally while she was vice president. Ms. Harris said the former president only looked after the rich. She said Mr. Trump would be manipulated by dictators if he returned to power and suggested his criticisms of NATO were an attempt to appease Russia's president Vladimir Putin. Shortly after the debate, the hugely influential pop star Taylor Swift endorsed Kamala Harris, saying the Democratic candidate fought for the rights and causes she believed in. Figures released this morning have revealed the economy did not grow in July. Analysts had predicted slight growth, but the Office for National Statistics said GDP was up by 0.5% in the 3 months to July. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, responded to the figures, saying the government was taking long-term decisions to fix the economy. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, and his US counterpart, Antony Blinken, are visiting Ukraine as part of a joint demonstration of support for Kyiv. They'll discuss the easing of rules preventing Ukraine from using weapons donated by the West inside Russia. The National Audit Office says the training of Ukrainian troops in Britain is affecting the UK's ability to train its own soldiers. The spending watchdog says a quarter of the army's training land is being used by Ukrainian troops. The Ministry of Defence said all UK forces had access to the relevant training required to protect the UK and meet NATO commitments. The government will introduce a bill to Parliament today aimed at providing greater security for renters in England. It'll include a ban on so-called no-fault evictions. The previous government has also proposed such measures, but they were dropped because of the general election. Amazon has announced it will invest £8 billion over the next 5 years to build and maintain massive data centres in the UK. The Chancellor welcomed the plans, which Amazon says will eventually support 14,000 jobs.
Thank you very much. Let us turn now to the vexed issue of social media, because we hear again and again, don't we, from psychologists, from teachers, from parents, that the social media generation hooked to their phones are miserable and damaged, perhaps, as no other generation has been. That's the charge, anyway. When it comes to solutions, it gets more vague, which is why a move from the Australian government is making waves around the world. They're proposing to introduce a ban, a simple ban, on social media for children. They're slightly unclear about what exactly the age would be. It would use age verification, whatever the age was that they decided, and they say that that verification works. Here, Ofcom estimate as many as 60% of 8 to 11-year-olds have social media profiles. It's about 1.5 million children across the UK. Let's talk first to Lauren Lefebvre, who is the founder of the Breck Foundation, which educates young people about how to stay safe online. Her own 14-year-old son was killed 10 years ago after being groomed online. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Are you convinced, first of all, that what the Australians are proposing is practical, could work?
Well, I think my first inclination is to sort the children under 13. You know, those statistics you've just listed, the 8 to 11 year olds that shouldn't even be on social media legally, and yet the social media platforms allow these children in by them just lying about their age. I think actually I want this to work with all of my heart, because when we look at how children are suffering from the adverse effects, maybe we are allowing them to have these adverse effects pushed towards them on social media. And why wouldn't we want them to have a more wholesome lifestyle, to be able to flourish, to see what they could actually achieve when they weren't sent constant, algorithms and content through the algorithms that are dangerous and harmful to them?
What do you think the right age cutoff should be?
I think that's very difficult, because we all know that children mature at different ages. But when you think about what they're being pushed, unhealthy content, whether it's glorifying self-harm or inappropriate eating techniques leading to eating disorders, you know, it, not to mention all the bullying, the grooming, everything that they're, having thrown towards them. I actually have now started to think maybe 16 is actually the right age. Originally, I thought, well, let's just try to get the 13-year-olds safe and keep out those younger primary school children. But to be honest, if I see, you know, within my work, children are suffering with so many sort of anxieties and mental health issues, and I feel that it's just exacerbated by what they're seeing and what they're viewing and how they're being so pushed into peer pressure to do things that they have to keep up with their friends. Why give them a lifestyle that almost emulates work, having to post, having to prove themselves? Let them just build up their skill sets. Let them study, learn, play, have a childhood, have rites of passage. It's almost their basic human right to have this childhood, and social media companies have taken that away. And we've accidentally, as parents and communities, allowed them to do this. So I would like to see it at 16. I'd love to see our young people be able to enjoy their young lives.
Okay, Lauren Lefebvre, thank you very much. Let us turn to Baroness Kidron, Beben Kidron, who is a leading voice on children's rights in the digital world. She's a crossbench peer in the House of Lords and has long been had a specialism in this area. Lady Kidron, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Can we start with the practicalities of it? The Australian government seems to be convinced that there could be facial recognition technology that could work and be relatively certain about how old a child is. And yet here we are not so sure, are we? I'm just looking at Ofcom's latest thoughts on this subject, where they say they think there's limited independent evidence, as they put it, that age assurance technology can correctly distinguish between children in different age groups. But what's your view on what is right and what is wrong when it comes to whether or not it could work?
Well, let me just start by saying, I mean, Lauren was so powerful then, but she kept on talking about the algorithms and the addiction and the things that the companies are requiring of children. So I have to say, and I will obviously answer your question about age assurance, that the end game should be designing better products, not necessarily, you know, pushing it uphill onto the tech companies to say, hang on a minute, you are treating children inappropriately rather than simply just taking kids out of the digital world. I mean, as to the practicalities, we've had for 2 or 3 years plenty of ways of doing it, whether it is by voice, biometrics, training moderators to understand behavioral signals, keywords, you know, happy birthday and realizing that someone's underage, or even flagging, you know, people as being underage and so on. There are multiple signals, multiple technologies. What we don't have is either the requirement to do it or a sort of a regulatory wraparound to say, are you doing it in a way that is protecting the privacy and that we can check the accuracy and that you can go back and challenge a wrong decision easily, you know, to press of a button.
Right. So you're saying, hang on, just to be clear, you're saying this technology exists. It could be good. It will not always be right. You ought to be able to challenge it. And in those circumstances where Ofcom say, we don't yet think it's working well enough, to paraphrase what they say, you say, no, it could work.
Well, yes, and I think what you have to remember is what the Australian government have announced is a large-scale trial, and they will, out of that trial, actually push the technology, and they'll be able to put around rules around, you know, if you check a child's age, it doesn't mean you have to share their identity or their location or other private things that we don't want them to share. But I do come back to this point that I am worried that we immediately go to the ban, because we are sending a mixed message to young people. We go, tech is coming for your livelihood. It is going to be the future, but you're not invited to this party. And so what we really should do is, yes, age assurance technology should be brought in. It should be safe. It should be private and it should be tested. Absolutely. And I'm right behind the Australian government doing that. But it is not instead of actually insisting that we build products that are not deliberately designed to addict, not toxic, and that are actually designed for the audiences that they're dealing with.
This conversation will unquestionably go on this programme for the time being, though. Lady Kidron, thank you very much.
It will indeed. It's 18 minutes to 8.
And it was a huge night in American politics. Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump. Not many questions answered, it's fair to say, but the candidates certainly had time to reveal more about themselves, or perhaps to confirm existing views of them to the wider nation. Tom Bateman watched it all unfold.
Face to face. Historic. The ABC News presidential debate.
In a city that was at the heart of the American Revolution, a debate described by its hosts as this election's most consequential moment.
Good evening, I'm David Muir, and thank you for joining us for tonight.
And as it began, it wasn't just the first debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, but the first time they'd met.
Kamala Harris, let's have a good debate.
Nice to see you. Have fun.
Thank you.
Kicking off on the economy, a key area of vulnerability for the vice president.
I've never seen a worse period of time. People can't go out and buy cereal or bacon or eggs or anything else. The people of our country are absolutely dying with what they've done. They've destroyed the economy.
Vice President Harris, I do want to ask for your response. And you heard what the president said there, because the Biden administration did keep a number of the Trump tariffs in place. So how do you respond?
Well, let's be clear that the Trump administration resulted in a trade deficit, one of the highest we've ever seen in the history of America. He invited trade wars.
Throughout, Mr. Trump kept trying to steer things back to his favorite issue, immigration, accusing the Biden-Harris White House of losing control. He then raised a false story originating from social media about Haitian immigrants in Ohio that had already been debunked.
They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country, and it's a shame.
I just want to clarify here. You bring up Springfield, Ohio, and ABC News did reach out to the city manager there. He told us there have been no credible reports of specific claims of pets being harmed, injured, or abused by individuals within the immigrant community.
Well, I've seen people on television.
Several times, the moderators challenged Donald Trump for making misleading claims. He appeared irritated, at times getting angry, which led to Kamala Harris's chosen tactic of trying to bait him further. They sparred on abortion rights, an area the Democrats see as a vote winner for them.
And now in over 20 states, there are Trump abortion bans, which make it criminal for a doctor or nurse to provide health care. In one state, it provides prison for life.
They have abortion in the ninth month. They even have, and you can look at the governor of West Virginia, the previous governor of West Virginia, not the current governor, who's doing an excellent job, but the governor before, he said the baby will be born and we will decide what to do with the baby. In other words, we'll execute the baby.
There is no state in this country where it is legal to kill a baby after it's born. Madam Vice President, I want to get your response to President Trump.
Well, as I said, you're going to hear a bunch of lies.
The strategies of each became clear. He sought to portray her as dangerously liberal, with a failed record under Joe Biden, which was destroying the country. She attempted to marginalise him as unserious but dangerously bent on power for his own self-interest.
These dictators and autocrats are rooting for you to be president again because they're so clear they can manipulate you with flattery and favours.
On the war in Gaza, Kamala Harris was challenged over the vast numbers of Palestinians killed and on the failure to release the remaining hostages. She repeated her commitments to both Israel's security and ultimately a two-state solution with the Palestinians. But Mr. Trump accused her of sowing chaos.
She hates Israel. At the same time, in her own way, she hates the Arab population because the whole place is going to get blown up. Arabs, Jewish people, Israel. Israel will be gone.
That's absolutely not true. I have my entire career and life supported Israel and the Israeli people. He knows that. He's trying to, again, divide and distract.
There was rigorous questioning by the moderators of the former president's position on Russia. They asked Mr. Trump whether he wanted Ukraine to win the war, to which he would say only he wanted the war to stop. Afterwards, in the media spin room, a clamour by reporters as VIP backers of both candidates claimed a win. This was the first and probably the only Trump-Harris election matchup in this format. The number of people still to be persuaded is vanishingly small, and it is their verdict on last night's debate that will be decisive.
Tom Bateman reporting there. Now, at 13 minutes to 8, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Tina Beattie, a writer and Catholic theologian.
Good morning. The way we treat people in prison is a central theme in Christianity. When Jesus identifies himself with the most marginalised and suffering people in society, he tells his followers, "I was in prison and you visited me." Elsewhere, he repeats the words of the prophet Isaiah, saying that he has been sent to preach the good news to the poor and to set the captives free. Such teachings are often spiritualised, so that they lose their radical edge and become domesticated. But this week, that theme of liberty for captives is an urgent social challenge. An estimated 1,700 prisoners are being released early in England and Wales to free up space in the overcrowded prison system. This will have an impact on many lives and communities. Some of those being released will have mental health struggles, exacerbated by having been confined in an often chaotic and dangerous environment. Many will find themselves homeless, without jobs or incomes, vulnerable to exploitation. Though violent offenders will not be released, victims of crime and their loved ones may be traumatised by the knowledge that their attackers are free. But the challenge of responding to the needs and anxieties of those released from prison and their victims is the tip of the iceberg, for the crisis in the criminal justice system is symptomatic of a deeper social malaise. A quote attributed to Fyodor Dostoevsky observes that a society should not be judged by how it treats its outstanding citizens, but by how it treats its criminals. People who commit crimes often have a history of poverty, neglect, and social exclusion. It's not surprising that many who grew up feeling abandoned by society can have little sense of responsibility to others. A recent report by the Institute for Public Policy Research says that children from low-income backgrounds and from some ethnic minorities and those with special needs or mental health issues are disproportionately excluded from school. Such early experiences of rejection can become a breeding ground for feelings of alienation and rage expressed in criminal acts. Of course, many people overcome painful childhoods to become good citizens and high achievers. But the Christian faith is a call to be attentive to those on the margins. The letter to the Hebrews exhorts the early Christian community to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering. I wonder how many Christian preachers this Sunday will dare to preach such a radical message to their congregations.
And that was Thought for the Day with Tina Beattie. The time, 10 to 8.
Tomorrow, a major review into the health of the NHS is to be published. And one of the first things this new government commissioned after winning power, the renowned NHS surgeon and independent peer Lord Darcy is to share his findings. Chief amongst his observations are expected to be waiting times across the board. Chris Payne had to wait in A&E with his two-year-old daughter for 7.5 hours before she was seen.
I went into A&E because my daughter was bleeding from the nose and it wouldn't stop. She complained of a headache and we were told that she had severe nappy rash, only for it later to be diagnosed as a UTI. We were told where to wait and 7.5 hours later, we were finally seen. The A&E, there wasn't many people waiting there, but there wasn't a lot of staff. I think I saw one doctor. I overheard somebody saying I'd been waiting 8 hours. So it wasn't just us. As a parent, it made me feel that I'd let my child down, that I'd made the wrong choice by taking her to that particular A&E department. When people bring in their kids, the one thing that they want to happen is for their kids to be better. But for that to happen, they need to be seen in a quick time frame and not be made to wait around for 7.5 hours while their child is in an agonising pain.
Well, you've been getting in touch this morning to share your experiences of the NHS as well, and many of them positive, including Sabrina Gledhill.
I have had surgery with the NHS on 3 or 4 occasions in the last 10 years. They have saved me from life in a wheelchair because I was diagnosed with quadriquina. I'm not saying the NHS doesn't have its faults, but we must preserve it.
There's also an email from Tim who says, as a surgeon in the NHS, I have waiting lists that were growing before COVID hit, which are still problematic. I've offered to do extra operating at weekends and I've been told I cannot because of finance and my patients, and because my patients are not breaching the longest target yet. Dame Julie Moore, former chief executive of University Hospitals Birmingham NHS Foundation Trust and still works in the NHS, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
This review then that's coming out tomorrow, you know, just even hearing that first story about waiting times in A&E and also with a child, what are you expecting to be the top part of this, the sort of priority?
I think Lord Darzi is a very thoughtful, considered clinician who knows the NHS well, and he will have gone into this very thoroughly. And waiting times are indeed one of the most shocking ways that the NHS has deteriorated over the past years. And in fact, the comment by your surgeon that waiting times were rising before COVID is correct. COVID made it a lot worse. But in fact, waiting times have been deteriorating since 2015-16, when we started to see routine surgery times rising, even cancer waiting times started to get worse then. And I think you can directly attribute that to funding.
And on that, that's what will be probably also highlighted, where it's not been kept to pace with other countries, the funding of the NHS.
No, the NHS started, there's the quote, something about democracy is the worst except for all the rest. And I think the NHS is the best system, but it can go wrong. It has fewer beds, members of health professions, scanning equipment, diagnostic equipment than most of the rest of the developed world. And yet it did really well. And for years, the Commonwealth Fund rated it as the best health system in the world. And then in 2020, it would sunk right down that league table. And I think you can directly look back at the way the funding started to dry up during austerity and continued. And we did not keep pace. We did not invest in the NHS. And so the words being said now, it's broken. I think it's been neglected over recent years. It can be the best. It was the best.
And yet, do you believe it can get back to that?
I absolutely do. I'm pretty old now, and I remember when the NHS wasn't hitting any waiting times targets. There weren't any. And I thought it was a bit difficult when the targets were first introduced, but we did it. And we made, in 2008, 9, 10, right through, we were hitting every waiting times target. 95% of patients treated within 18 weeks. Nobody waited more than 4 hours in A&E. We can do that. But it's going to take time to do it because we haven't got the staff. You can't build new buildings overnight, or indeed you can buy new equipment, but you have to have the staff to run it. And it's going to take that investment. And alongside the fact, we're in a new era now. We have different IT and technology, and the NHS has not always proved itself very good at investing in the modern technology that other industries use. And we really have to look at that and how we can use those tools to make life better for patients and staff in the NHS.
How much time do you think it takes when you talk about, you know, getting back to brilliance?
Last time it took 3 years. When the last Labour government came in, they stabilised the funding position and stabilised waiting times. And it took 3 years before waiting times started to fall. Now, there's a more ambitious plan now, but it is relying on staff to work additional lists and sessions. But the NHS staff have always gone the extra mile. The problem is now that there are fewer of them, and a lot were very exhausted following COVID. So I don't think there are the staff around. So I think that this time it's a much harder job to do that. And if you look at the impact COVID had, and I think Lord Darzi is going to say something about that, one of the reasons is that our buildings have not kept pace with modern healthcare. So if you had a building with lots of single rooms and modern ventilation systems, you were better able to cope with COVID than if you were in a very old building where the beds were closer together in large multi-occupancy rooms. Then you couldn't use them for all those patients, which is why we had such a big hit over COVID as well. So we need to invest in the estate, the equipment, and most of all in the staff. And don't forget technology in this.
Do you think A&E could be solved quicker, though?
Well, I think there's several things that could help A&E. Firstly, I think we do need to invest in primary care. Primary care should be the first port of call for most patients to go to. And sometimes this is portrayed as a battle between hospital funding should be moved to GPs. Well, actually, we need to invest in GPs and hospitals to make sure that that happens, so patients have got quick and rapid access to GPs. I think that there are other walk-in centres that have proved themselves invaluable in this. But we need to invest in the staff to make sure that they are there to see patients when they're needed. It's a shocking tale, somebody waiting 7 hours with a child in A&E, but it's a shocking tale for anybody waiting that long, anybody with an elderly relative. And one of the other big problems that we've not mentioned yet this morning is social care. Many of our hospital beds, and several reports have said it's about 13 to 15% of beds are occupied by patients who no longer need the care of an acute hospital bed, but can't get appropriate care either in their own home or in a social care setting. Well, that's just misuse of resources, but giving people poor care.
Well, we hope to be able to put this to the government tomorrow. Dame, when the report is out, Dame Julie Moore, thank you.
2 minutes to eight to the weather, Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Justin. We've got a cold northwesterly airflow coming in at the moment, so a fresher feeling day. Quite blustery, but not as windy as yesterday, with a mix of sunshine and showers. Now, this morning, most of the showers are across the northwest of the UK. So for Wales, northwest England, southwest Scotland, northern Scotland and Northern Ireland, showers pretty frequent through the morning hours. There's a few thunderstorms in the mix, a bit of hail around as well, and they're going to continue into the afternoon as well. So on and off showers, blustery winds gusting 30, perhaps 40 miles an hour in the northwest, and temperatures 10 to 13. For the rest of the UK, so that's all of southern England, the Midlands, eastern England, northeast England and eastern Scotland, not many showers this morning, a lot of dry weather. We've just got a few down towards the southwest of England, but as we head into the afternoon, cloud will bubble up across the rest of the region and those showers become more frequent. Hail and thunderstorms in the mix as well, with blustery winds. Top temperatures 12 to 15 today, and it's going to turn cold overnight tonight.
Thanks very much. Well, later this morning, Gabriel Gatehouse begins a new investigation.
We are at war!
There's a new divide in American politics between those who think democracy's in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside.
January 6th, in many ways, is a crime of continued rebellion.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and as America gets ready to choose its next president, follow me through the looking glass into a parallel world where nothing is as it seems.
I think somebody's trying to cover it up.
The new series of The Coming Storm, starting this morning at 9:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
After 8 o'clock, we'll be looking more, of course, at the presidential debate overnight. We'll be asking who won, and we'll be hearing from both sides about their candidates' performances.
We will. And you are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. Good to be with you today. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 11th of September. Their headlines this morning. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have taken part in a sometimes ill-tempered televised debate, repeatedly accusing each other of lying and clashing on issues such as immigration and their records in office. New figures show the UK economy didn't grow in July. President Zelensky of Ukraine will set out his case for using Western long-range missiles against Russia when he meets the Foreign Secretary and his US counterpart in Kyiv. And the government will introduce legislation to overhaul the rental housing market in England. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The two candidates to be President of the United States have traded claims and criticisms about immigration, abortion and the economy in their only scheduled televised debate ahead of the campaign. The event in Philadelphia began with a handshake before Kamala Harris and Donald Trump went on to repeatedly accuse each other of lying. The vice president said Mr. Trump would offer tax cuts to billionaires, while the former president said Ms. Harris had turned the US into a failing country. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, was watching the debate and sent this report.
A combative Kamala Harris clearly intended to try to rile Donald Trump, and she obviously succeeded in getting under his skin. He looked distinctly rattled, as she said he was fired by millions of voters at the last election. The people leave his campaign rallies early because they get bored, and that he's disrespected on the world stage.
It is absolutely well known that these dictators and autocrats are rooting for you to be president again because they're so clear they can manipulate you with flattery and favors.
Unaccustomed to being on the defensive, Donald Trump stuck closely to his most familiar talking points, constantly referring to the high numbers of illegal migrants entering America, saying they're committing crimes, and even claiming, without evidence, that they're killing people's pets.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country.
You talk about extreme.
Afterwards, Donald Trump claimed this was his best debate yet, as he made a surprise appearance in the media center, just as the Harris campaign suggested doing another debate next month.
They immediately called for a second debate because they lost.
Kamala Harris's performance was far from flawless, but she obviously thinks she came out on top, which is why she wants to do it all again before Election Day.
Moments after the broadcast finished, Kamala Harris was boosted by an endorsement from Taylor Swift. Writing on Instagram, the highly influential pop singer said the Democratic candidate fought for the rights and causes she believed in. She said she felt she had to make the announcement after an AI deep fake reposted by Donald Trump appeared to show her endorsing him. The debate was the first time the two candidates had met, and it was being closely watched in a race which polls suggest is neck and neck. A small number of states will decide the result, as they're known to switch from one party to the other. Our North America correspondent, John Sudworth, was in one of them last night, Michigan, to gauge reaction to the debate.
The race to the White House could be won or lost in places like Michigan's Macomb County, still a bedrock of the US car industry and the kind of voters the Democrats could once have banked on. The United Auto Workers Union is backing Kamala Harris, and at a union event watching on a big screen, they whooped and clapped for her put-downs of Donald Trump. One previously undecided voter told me she had seen enough to convince her to vote against him. But there's plenty of cause for concern here for Democrats too. One union organizer told me that his father and his uncles, all lifelong union members, had gone over to Trump, and he wasn't sure about his sons either.
For more analysis on the presidential debate, you can listen to the latest Americast podcast. That's available now on BBC Sounds. Figures which have been published this morning show that the UK economy failed to grow in July. Analysts had forecast slight growth, but the Office for National Statistics said output in the production and construction sectors fell. Here's our chief economics correspondent, Darshini David.
A so-called summer of sport with events from the Euros to Wimbledon saw a boost to sales of food, drink and leisure activities in July. However, that growth in the services sector was cancelled out by a poor month for manufacturing and construction. These monthly figures are volatile and follow solid growth across the first half of the year, suggesting the economy remains in recovery mode after last year's short-lived recession. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has highlighted that the UK has underperformed on growth on average since the 2008 financial crisis. The challenge for her, as October's budget approaches, is to increase that momentum and maintain it. But, as she acknowledges, change is unlikely to happen overnight.
A number of Labour MPs say they'll keep pressing the government to provide support for pensioners in England and Wales who are losing their winter fuel payments. 50 Labour MPs either abstained or were absent from yesterday's Commons vote, which backed the government's plan. The BBC says at least 20 are opposed to the policy. Downing Street says the measure is necessary to deal with the budget deficit. The Foreign Secretary David Lammy and his US counterpart Antony Blinken are visiting Ukraine in a joint demonstration of support for the country. They'll discuss President Zelensky's demands to use long-range American and British missiles against targets in Russia. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale is travelling with the Foreign Secretary and sent this report.
This is the first joint overseas visit by a foreign secretary and US Secretary of State for more than a decade. A trip designed, officials say, to emphasise unified transatlantic support for Ukraine. But what leaders in Kyiv want is not so much support, but permission. The right to use American and British long-range missiles against targets in Russia. Chief among them, air bases used by Russian warplanes to launch devastating glide bombs against Ukraine. So far, that permission has been withheld amid US fears of Russian escalation. But Antony Blinken said he and Mr. Lammy wanted to hear directly from President Zelensky what he wants and report back to President Biden and Sir Keir Starmer, who are due to discuss the use of missiles in Washington on Friday. We are listening intently to our Ukrainian partners, Mr. Blinken said, and US congressmen believe a change in American policy is imminent.
The government's spending watchdog says the training of Ukrainian troops is affecting the UK's efforts to train its own soldiers. An investigation by the National Audit Office found that a quarter of the army's training estate was being used to help Ukrainian troops. The Ministry of Defence said all UK forces had access to relevant training required to protect the UK and meet NATO commitments. Here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
The Ministry of Defence has made supporting Ukraine its main focus for more than 2 years now, at a cost of nearly £8 billion. Under a programme called Operation Interflex, more than 45,000 Ukrainian troops have completed basic infantry and other training in Britain. Most say it made them better prepared for war. But there is a downside to this. Last year, the report found British Army units bidding for training space got their bids rejected 8 times more than the year before, because they were already being used by Ukrainians. Specialist training for the Royal Marines risked being so compromised by this that it had to be moved to the Netherlands in February. The report also identified an insufficiency of training on drones, an aspect of modern warfare that has become key to the war in Ukraine.
The BBC has been given rare access to a treatment centre for Mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Health workers in South Kivu, one of the worst affected regions in the country, said they were desperate, with infections rising, supplies running low, and no information about when they'll get much needed vaccines. Our Africa correspondent, Simi Jalosho, reports from Goma.
Just over 3 weeks ago, Luido Hospital in South Kivu was used to treat all sorts of diseases and conditions. They tended to around 80 patients a month, but the outbreak worsened to the point they had to convert it into an Mpox-only treatment centre. Within 3 weeks, they've had nearly 200 patients. Healthcare workers say they need more supplies, clean water and more medicine. They haven't recorded any deaths as more people in the community are aware of Mpox, but there's fear of a new wave of infections. The government said it's doing its best to get medics what they need and vaccinations will begin early October.
The government will introduce a bill to Parliament today which represents the biggest overhaul to England's rental market in more than 3 decades. The Renters' Rights Bill will ban so-called no-fault evictions. It'll allow for the right to have pets and will enforce a timescale on landlords to repair properties. The head of the National Residential Landlords Association, Ben Beadle, said he supported a fair deal for renters but told us it wouldn't tackle the fundamental issue of a lack of housing.
Whilst this will bring forward greater regulation, what it won't do is bring forward additional homes that we so desperately need, either in the social or the rented sector. We have, on average, 17 tenants applying to rent one property. And so until we actually deal with the core issue, that's not going to get better through these changes. In some respects, it may well get worse because it may force good landlords out of the sector.
Amazon is to invest £8 billion in the UK over the next 5 years to create massive data centres to support the growth of cloud computing and artificial intelligence. The company says the move will ultimately lead to around 14,000 jobs.
Thank you. 8:10 is the time. She had signalled to the world what she was going to do. It was obvious. Kamala Harris intended to use the debate with Donald Trump to needle him and make him say things that would be off-putting to Americans still wondering how to vote. And she did it. Right from the start, when she strode across the stage and offered her hand to him, forcing a handshake that he did not look to be planning on. In one exchange in the ABC News presidential debate, Harris told Trump he got fired by 81 million people and is having a difficult time processing that. Not everyone, she said, got handed $400 million on a silver platter and then filed for bankruptcy 6 times. She also sought to goad him on his rallies.
You will see during the course of his rallies, he talks about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. He will talk about windmills cause cancer. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom. And I will tell you, the one thing you will not hear him talk about is you.
First, let me respond as to the rallies. She said people start leaving. People don't go to her rallies. There's no reason to go. And the people that do go, she's bussing them in and paying them to be there and then showing them in a different light. So she can't talk about that. People don't leave my rallies.
Donald Trump also called her a Marxist and tried to get her to talk about her own record as vice president and the things she used to believe but no longer does, including that fracking for oil and gas should be banned. But to many observers, he seemed off his game. He seemed incapable of landing his points. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, was in the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia.
It's absolutely remarkable to watch Donald Trump on the ropes like this, clearly trying to control his temper, although not always absolutely succeeding, and just frankly looking a bit flummoxed that he was put on the defensive with a plan Kamala Harris had clearly come with to try and get under his skin. And the result was that he sounded a little incoherent. I don't think he came into this debate planning to make the unfounded accusation that migrants are eating pet cats and dogs in some American cities, which the moderators had to say wasn't true. She obviously got to him, and although he was able to keep returning to the main points he wanted to make about high levels of immigration and about high prices and inflation, he just didn't seem to be in control of this debate at all. And I think it's a sign of quite how rattled he was by it all that he has recently appeared where I am at the moment in the press filing room, where usually it's candidate surrogates who come and talk to the press. Well, Donald Trump himself has just turned up.
I mean, that does suggest, doesn't it, that he is breaking free, and not necessarily a good sense, from the control of the people who are trying to keep him on message.
Absolutely. And he's turned up here telling reporters that she lost the debate very badly, that he thinks that he had a great night. In fact, he says he thinks it's the best debate he's ever done. Now, when it comes to Donald Trump, you know that when he's repeating things like that, it's because he's not absolutely sure they're true, but he wants us to believe them. And Kamala Harris's advisors very quickly afterwards put out a message saying, that was fun, let's do it again in October. So he says, oh, well, she's only calling for a second debate because she knows she lost that one. But this is somebody who clearly knows he's on the back foot here and has some ground to make up. Yeah.
It is fair to say, isn't it, that there were several moments in the debate where she was asked why she had changed her view on some quite key subjects. And she never really got to answering that.
She has this line that she says her values haven't changed, but her policies have on some of them. She's very, very clear to say that she is in favour of fracking, although she previously had a position saying she wanted to ban fracking, and that's an important issue in this election, particularly in the key state of Pennsylvania, which is where this debate was taking place. On the others, she didn't come up with a great explanation, but Donald Trump wasn't able to capitalise on things like that because she'd wrong-footed him so badly. So although, you know, she was put in a far from perfect performance in many ways, but she was able to get away with that because he just wasn't landing the blows. Although when he mischaracterized her positions on things or told lies about other issues, she was straight in there saying, that's not true. And that's something Joe Biden really didn't manage to do in the last debate, but she was all over him whenever she wanted to land the point that he was coming up with mistruths.
And she has the endorsement now of Taylor Swift in the immediate aftermath of this debate.
Absolutely. Taylor Swift took to social media and said that she's going to be voting for the Harris-Waltz ticket. Now, of course, that is potentially very, very valuable just because Taylor Swift has such a huge online reach. And Taylor Swift signed that post, Childless Cat Lady, which, of course, is a dig at J.D. Vance, Donald Trump's running mate, who said that there were too many childless cat ladies running the country. And Taylor Swift always clearly identifies herself as that, coming in just straight off the back of this debate, which another boost to the Harris-Waltz campaign, who I think are feeling very pleased with themselves tonight.
Right, that was Sarah Smith, a North America editor, talking to me just seconds after the debate had ended. What do the partisans make of it all? Let's start with the Democrats, the Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro.
I think most importantly, Kamala Harris laid out a very positive, optimistic vision for the country and the fact that she's going to work hard every day to create an opportunity economy for all Americans, and that she wants to bring Americans together rather than Donald Trump, who has for 8 or 9 years now divided people with resentment and fear and, you know, just done everything he can to pull people apart. And she talked about some of the dangers of his plan and the Republican plan known as Project 2025, a national abortion ban, for example, which has led to just horrible scenarios where women who have miscarried or don't have viable pregnancies are forced or turned away from hospital treatment, from doctor's treatment, because those doctors are afraid of incurring some kind of legal wrath by Republican governors or attorneys general. And so she spelled out the dangers of a Donald Trump presidency very well.
And she needled him a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that she was able to successfully get under his skin. You know, Donald Trump is a very vain and thin-skinned person. And so you saw him often react to these tangents rather than lay out any kind of policy solutions or vision for the country.
She didn't answer, though, a single question, did she, about why she has changed her mind on a whole range of subjects, which was obviously deliberate. Do you think that's the right thing to do, or is that going to lead to people saying, hang on a second, this candidate is inauthentic? Yes, she can needle Donald Trump. Yes, she can make strong points about abortion, etc. But actually, when it comes to her own record, she's refusing to level with the American people about why it's changed so much.
I don't think there's anyone in American politics who has flip-flopped their positions more than Donald Trump.
Yeah, but what about her positions, though?
Or who has been more hypocritical in their positions than Donald Trump. Yeah, she laid out what she's done as vice president. She talked about fracking, for example, and how she had actually voted for the Inflation Reduction Act, which allowed for fracking. I remember that was one example that she gave.
But she didn't explain why she's changed her mind. I suppose that's the point. And you're saying she doesn't really need to.
Yeah, I mean, she said her experience as vice president. I think she's said that a few times in interviews, that the experience of being vice president versus running as a candidate or serving in the Senate, it's obviously a very different position, and you're entrusted with the nation. And so she's got a record to run on, and she's spelled out very clearly her vision for the future. Donald Trump has not only flip-flopped his positions and been hypocritical in his positions, but also has laid out no vision for the country.
At one stage, she said that she owned a handgun, which she has said before, but she was much criticized for by her fellow Democrats when she said it before back in the 2020 election round. Interesting that she chose to bring that up. She is running now, isn't she, from the center, even the right of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think she's just stating a fact. I mean, she owns a gun.
Yeah, but she didn't need to state it. That's the point. And she did state it. She wanted it to be out there.
Yeah, as I recall during the debate, I think that he had said that she was going to take people's guns away and so forth. And I think that's why she pointed out that she herself, along with Tim Walz, oh, they own a gun. And remember, you know, one of the attacks by Republicans, a disingenuous attack, is that Democrats want to take away everybody's guns, whereas Democrats have been very clear that that's not our intention. And there are many Democrats who have guns at home for self-defense in case somebody breaks into your home at 3 o'clock in the morning and you need to protect yourself or your family. So people do own guns.
That was Joaquin Castro, the congressman from Texas. Let us hear then from the Republican. Sam Nunberg has been talking to me. He still supports Donald Trump, but he agreed that Mr. Trump did not have his best night.
Unfortunately for President Trump, he did take the bait, and the Harris campaign had come out. They broadcast that they were going to try to get under his skin, and he wasted valuable time, sometimes defending accusations and comments that she was making, such as about crowd sizes, people leaving his rallies, and other issues that are really not important for the debate at hand. And I was also quite surprised, to tell you the truth, that not only did he just defend himself against her swipes, but he really didn't get into the dirt with her.
But on that, there's a set of things, aren't there, where she has changed her mind, to put it mildly. She now seems to believe things that are completely different to the things that she once believed. Did you feel at all that he hit any of those home?
He surely did, if you heard some of his responses. But I would agree that he didn't really give a straight fact delivery about, here are her positions from 2019, here were her positions as recently as a year ago, and now she is promising to be almost to the right of me in some of these policies. And on the other hand, what I would say is that he did have a very strong line. He did say that she would revert to her liberal track record and her liberal beliefs the minute that she's elected, and that these are false promises. Now, the one thing you would also note, though, is that he continued to hit her on fracking, as the Trump campaign has continually across the critical state of Pennsylvania. And she made a comment about Poland, and Trump would give away Poland to Putin, and said that, I wonder what the 800,000 Polish people of descent in Pennsylvania think about that. And so there was a focus particularly on energy. But part of the issue is that she was very well prepared. Now, people like me that aren't directly connected with the campaign never underestimated her.
There was an extraordinary moment where President Trump was asked by the moderators, wasn't he, whether he wanted Ukraine to win in its war with Russia. And he didn't say that he did want Ukraine to win. For the Republican Party, that's quite a change, isn't it, from the Reagan years?
Well, it certainly is. And the stance of basically the majority of the party is that we would like the war to come to a peaceful ending. Now, he does not go into particularity about what that means. And by the way, I would also say that is not my personal position. I don't think that Vladimir Putin or Russia should have an extra inch of Ukrainian land. But Donald Trump is someone who is frankly against foreign wars. And as I worked for him for 6 years earlier, he is not somebody who wants foreign adventures. And I think that he is also extremely, and he brought it up, extremely worried about the nuclear issues, which Putin has threatened repeatedly.
Final thought, do you think they'll debate again?
They actually are, at least if there is a report now in the news. And that is an indication to me. What I said was from the beginning of this to my friends and colleagues at the Trump campaign was, you'll know that you won this debate by the fact if she decides that she needs to debate him again. Because Kamala Harris, her biggest problem right now in such a swing election, an election that's up for grabs, 30% of the national electorate, and that also goes down into the critical battleground states, all say they don't know enough about her yet. And her campaign would have instantaneous data from certain swing voters that they poll as they're watching the debate. If she feels that she still needs to get them more information and has to then take the risk of standing across the stage from Donald Trump, where there's 80 million people watching and you never know what he's going to do, then that is not the position I assure you she would like to be in. So while you can certainly look at the presentation of Donald Trump, and it is not a typical politician, and he certainly wasn't the most energetic as I've seen him in other debates, what I would say is that he did better than you'll hear from the vast majority of political analysts across the world.
Sam Nunberg, thank you very much for talking to us.
23 minutes past eight. A life of meaning is about small acts, not big achievements. So it doesn't matter if you've lived a quiet life in the suburbs or been the president of the USA. It's about looking for happiness and kindness. Quite apt after hearing about last night's debate, but those are some of the many words penned by the aid worker Simon Boas, who's writing on living and dying in his local newspaper, the Jersey Evening Post, that went viral earlier this year. In July, in what was to be his last broadcast interview, I spoke to Simon about why he was so driven to share his approach to death and life, and in the knowledge that he wouldn't be here when those fruits of those writing labours came to fruition with the publication of his hastily put together book, A Beginner's Guide to Dying. Simon Boas died 11 days after our interview went out on this programme, and tributes were paid to him around the world. Tomorrow, his book will be published. And although Simon is not here for this moment, his wife, Aurelie Boas, is, and she kindly agreed to talk to me in her first broadcast interview about Simon, losing him, and what it's been like to share her husband with the many who took him and his message to their hearts. When we began our conversation, Aurelie reflected on her memories of Simon talking to me and the Today programme in that interview.
I remember him doing the interview. He realised slowly how big, you know, it could become.
Yes.
He knew we wouldn't see the book for sure. He saw the book cover made. It was done overnight, which I think was a record for the publisher to ever see a book cover done in 24 hours. That was wonderful to see him see the cover. But after that, I don't think he minded. First, he knew he wouldn't see the book, but I think he was trying so hard to let go of things. He knew he would have, it was done. He had done his part. He let it go.
What have the last few weeks been like for you?
The last few weeks since his death, very surreal, very amazing too. You know, I'm very lucky to have great support, great family. But I'm very aware, of course, that the launch of the book, it's a bit unusual to grieve maybe this way. Not everyone has such a baby to look after. It's a great responsibility for me to have to be in charge. But it's quite wonderful to have this
as a focus.
As a legacy. Yes, very much.
A legacy and the focus. But I suppose I also wonder what it's been like, you know, being married to somebody who spoke so publicly about death and his own comfort with death, and at the same time, you know, deal with the fact of how sad that was going to make you, because that's something that he struggled with, wasn't it? He talked about him making peace with it, but what kept him up at night was the impact on you and parents and family.
The way he was for months and months, we were lucky in a way to have so long to prepare. And I think he prepared me very well, consciously and unconsciously. He started being a bit detached from the practical things of life. I often felt lonely even before his death, in the sense that he was pulling away a bit.
Mm.
I think he might have done it naturally, but with an effort to actually gently free me, you know, away from him. And as sad as it is, as I feel like very grateful in the way that we managed to discuss everything for months, but also have normal days. You know, you start caring about the little thing. You might feel guilty about it, but that's the way it is. And being stressed about the little thing, thinking, how could I live this way when something so huge happened? But that's it.
What was the end like? A lot of people care deeply about Simon. They have bought very much into his way of thinking about death as a canvas upon which he paint life and how he framed life. How were his final days?
The final days were both surreal, magical, as strange as it sounds. We were very, very lucky to be able to go to the hospice in Jersey. You don't always choose, unfortunately, where you end up. I moved with him and I had a bed next to him the whole time I was there. And I packed all things, photos, photo frames, vases, cards from friends. We took everything with us. He wanted to see Jersey one last time. So we went through a drive. It was a lovely day all around the island. And then we moved in the hospice. And it sounds a bit crazy looking back, but it felt right. We had prepared all of that. We settled. We watched a lot of tennis. And then Simon drifted off as planned, you know. Slowly, he was less and less conscious. He kept his very good sense of humor, even when he was a bit out of it. He would have hallucinations where he would see dogs running through the court at Wimbledon. You know, things like this that made us laugh, all of us, because eventually he would have a moment where he would ask, is it possible that I saw a dog on the tennis court? We would say, no, but it's lovely. Lovely that you did. He was happy. I don't think he was scared. He was aware to an extent. He knew about the letter from the king. He knew about the book.
There was a letter from the king, is that right?
There was a letter from the king that was supposed to be delivered by hand when the king would come to Jersey on the day of his death. But when they realized that he wouldn't be alive that day, very likely, the lieutenant governor in Jersey came to the hospice to deliver the letter. And that was a beautiful moment. The governor left and Simon fell asleep again in a second after perking up for 15 minutes, which I didn't think he would manage. I'm picking it up today. I promised to Simon that it would be framed and put in the downstairs loom. So that's
where
my
else?
Mission. It's a beautiful letter of recognition, of thanks from the king and acknowledging, you know, his courage and his admiration. So that's very wonderful.
Has it been of comfort to share Simon with so many people? You know, to feel like people now know him and how he was thinking in those last few months?
Well, it's been a very interesting exercise for me to actually practice sharing him, because it's not in my nature to maybe reach out as much as he did. And as I wanted to close down and stay home and, you know, suspend time so we would just be together and enjoy each other's company until, you know, until it was the end, I had to share him.
Mm.
And I had to also let him go, because obviously he was way bigger than me. Who am I to say, no, please don't mention my name. We had discussions about, because Jersey is a small island. I felt quite exposed a few times.
Yes.
You know, my name or my photo, and then people I didn't know would comment on the way I looked in a photo. People stopped the car asking me about my dog, knowing my dog, which, you know, people I didn't know. I felt very exposed in a time where I felt very vulnerable too.
Mm.
So that was hard. And in that sense, I'm happy that's behind. I had to remind myself very often that, you know, it's not about me, all of this, if it's helping millions, and I think it has and it will. it's something I need to do. I need to share.
Just a final thought on faith. You know, a lot of people come to different thoughts towards the end of their life. Sometimes it comes about that they think about, is there something out there? And also, if they're grieving, what do they lean on and how they think about the world? You know, where are you with that? Where was Simon with that? How important has that sort of structure and system been for you?
He had been, he talked about it and of course wrote about it. He didn't convert overnight when he got sick, but he got definitely more open to the idea that he didn't know, which was big. He didn't know, but it was fine not knowing. But he did find comfort in the idea that there could be something.
Yes.
He was very reassured for himself that I believe in God and I always have. You know, I'm a Catholic. He find comfort in supposing that there could be something.
Aurélie, thank you very much for talking to me and to all of our listeners.
Thank you for having me very much.
Aurélie Boas there, and A Beginner's Guide to Dying by Simon Boas, that's the name of the book, is out tomorrow, and a portion of the proceeds will go to two international palliative care charities.
The time, 27 minutes to nine, to Simon Mundy with the sport.
In football's Nations League, the England captain Harry Kane scored twice on his 100th appearance as they beat Finland 2-0 at Wembley. Elsewhere in the group, the Republic of Ireland were beaten 2-0 by Greece in Dublin. Tennis, and Great Britain's Davis Cup captain Leon Smith has to make a decision by midday on whether US Open semi-finalist and British number one Jack Draper will play in the opening tie against Finland today. Draper picked up a niggle in his last four defeat to Yannick Sinner in New York, but practised in Manchester yesterday afternoon. Great Britain also face Argentina on Friday and then 2022 champions Canada on Sunday in Group D. And ahead of today's tie, I spoke to British Davis Cup veteran Dan Evans.
It's not an easy group at all. I think Finland are probably not a big, big tennis nation, but they've done good in this competition for a few years now. It's an even group, but I think we've got a good chance to go through. Regardless if Jack plays or not, obviously it would make it a lot easier if Jack does play. But if he doesn't, I think we've still got a good chance. We've got good options in singles and good options in doubles, to be honest with you. And I think we've got as good a chance as any to get through.
It is 15 years since your Davis Cup debut, and you could overtake Sir Andy Murray in terms of number of Davis Cup ties by a British player this week. Does that mean a lot to you?
I mean, any time I get to represent my country means a lot, and sort of pretty proud of the longevity I've been able to keep playing ties. And that's obviously, it's a nice thing to have, but hopefully this week I'll have it, but with a win at the end of it.
Dan, you are the team's most experienced player. Do you feel like the elder statesman?
Not really. I've played a lot of ties. I've enjoyed every tie, win or lose. I feel that you have to sort of lead the newer guys into the day-to-day stuff. You can sort of help them a bit with getting used to the surroundings and stuff. And I feel on court, I try and lead by example, and in practice, yeah, of course. But, you know, these guys are good professionals also.
Sir Andy Murray was on the Today programme on Monday. He said that he wants to continue to be involved in tennis at some point in the future. Would you like to see him as part of the GB Davis Cup setup?
Yeah, he'd be a good captain. I mean, I don't think he's going to just come and coach in Davis Cup. I think he'd want to be captain, and I think that would be his best job. If the opportunity arose, he'd be a great captain, yeah.
Obviously, you were part of Andy's tennis farewell with your gripping and emotional Olympic run. Where does that rank in terms of your tennis memories?
Yeah, it's right up there. It was obviously, you know, emotional end for what happened. Really exciting week. And to do it representing your country was pretty an amazing sort of fitting end for him. And to be part of it was an amazing feeling and an occasion, yeah.
Obviously, we've just had the end of the US Open. Jack Draper had that great run to the semi-finals. Expectations obviously rising. What do you think could stop him from going on and perhaps winning slams like Andy Murray did?
He's still pretty young, as I think tennis is really strong at the minute. So there's a lot of the players who would be going for those sort of titles. So there's Sinner and Alcaraz. That's going to be the most difficult part for him.
Dan Evans there. Today's tie starts at 1 p.m. and you can watch all of Great Britain's matches live on the BBC iPlayer, the BBC Sport website and Red Button.
Thanks very much for that. Now, if you want to know the secret to making unmissable radio, well, yeah, I think I could do that. Here's Tim Harford.
Apparently, the trick to creating compelling radio is conflict. So this week, we present a series of epic matchups: pensioners versus immigrants, oil tankers versus inertia, Energy Secretary Ed Miliband versus our crunching pedantry, randomised trials versus known unknowns, and our loyal listeners versus mathematician Katie Steckles. Who will triumph? There can be only one. That's More or Less with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds in half an hour.
And to the weather, cool and breezy, mixture of sunny spells and scattered showers. The showers heavy at times, the risk of thunder locally.
Sounds lovely. It's 23 minutes to nine. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. And let's get a summary of the news because Caroline Nichols has just walked in.
Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have faced each other in what can be the only televised debate of the US presidential election. At the event in Pennsylvania, they clashed over immigration, abortion and the economy. Ms. Harris accused the former president of only looking after the rich and said if he won, he would be manipulated by dictators. Mr. Trump called her a Marxist with no economic plan and said millions of people had entered the country illegally while she was vice president. Shortly after the debate, the hugely influential pop star Taylor Swift endorsed Kamala Harris, saying the vice president fought for the rights and causes she believed in. Figures published this morning show the UK economy did not grow in July. It's the second consecutive month of stagnation. The Office for National Statistics said the services sector grew, but manufacturing and the construction sector both shrank. The Foreign Secretary David Lammy and his American counterpart Antony Blinken are on a joint trip to Ukraine to show their support for the country. They'll discuss Ukraine's repeated requests to use long-range American and British missiles against targets in Russia.
Thanks very much for that, Caroline. It's 22 minutes to nine, and today, just talking about that last news story, let's find out a bit more, because today David Lammy will visit Kyiv with his US counterpart Antony Blinken, the first joint overseas visit by a foreign secretary and a US secretary of state for more than a decade. And it's designed, the trip, to demonstrate joint support for Ukraine. This comes as President Biden is no longer ruling out allowing Ukraine to fire missiles deep into Russian territory, a change of policy being considered after it emerged that Iran is now arming Russia with ballistic missiles, which could be used in Ukraine within weeks. Let's talk now to Oleksandr Merechko, the chair of Ukraine's Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can I just start by asking you to, and all of us, to have a listen and remind ourselves of what Donald Trump said last night in the presidential debate about ending the war in Ukraine?
That is a war that's dying to be settled. I will get it settled before I even become president. If I win, when I'm president-elect, and what I'll do is I'll speak to one, I'll speak to the other, I'll get them together. That war would have never happened.
Oleksandr, what do you make of that?
Well, I consider it to be pre-election rhetoric, and that's why it should be treated, so to speak, with a grain of salt. Because at the moment, I think both candidates are preoccupied with one goal, to win elections, and they don't have clear-cut plan how to win a war against Russian aggression in Ukraine.
So, okay, let's put that to that side then, having got your response and idea to that. But the idea of this trip then and how important it is today and potentially this change of policy from the US, give us the reaction in Ukraine.
Well, first of all, we look forward to host both foreign ministers. And to us, it's an unprecedented event in the sense that we haven't had such an important visit in the last 10 or even more years. And we're sure that both foreign ministers, they will bring some good news in terms of military support of Ukraine, in terms of support of Ukraine in the long run. But also, we do hope that they will the best news which they can bring right now is about lifting the ban on the use of Western weaponry, especially long-range missiles, in the territory of Russia.
And on that point, what would you say to those who need convincing that that is the right move?
Well, first of all, it's a necessity. It's military necessity because we're dealing with the so-called asymmetric conflict. And to win such war, we need to wage a war in the territory of the aggressor. And besides, you know, right now we're waging the war of defense with our hands tied behind our back. So we cannot respond in kind. And that's why we desperately need this permission to use Western weaponry, especially to hit the targets, those pockets which Russia is using to bombard Ukraine, to shell Ukrainian cities.
There is a concern, though, and this is why permission has been withheld, amongst other reasons, that there are, you know, about the fears of Russian escalation.
Well, to me, it's nothing but a myth because we already have escalation. And to me, it's hard to imagine something bigger. But there is also another myth called, we can call it the nuclear escalation. I don't believe in this for very simple reason, because Putin will not dare to use even tactical nuclear weapons. First of all, it's taboo in global politics. Second, he is afraid of reaction of his close partner China. China is against this, and Putin doesn't want to be left alone and doesn't want China to turn its back on him. He's afraid of this. And finally, his military command, his generals, they would be very careful to you. They don't want to be dragged into grave along with their Führer.
I mean, in terms of your strength of feeling, you couldn't be clearer on that. And there are those who have had those reservations. But there is also now this knowledge that has been confirmed of the role of Iran in all of this.
Yeah, as far as I know, around 200 missiles were provided by Iran to Russia. And Iran is aiding and abetting the war of aggression waged by Russia. It's genocidal war against Ukraine. And I hope there will be a reaction. Reaction on the part of our allies, our partners. And one of the, by the way, that's why we need to leave this ban on the use of missiles against Russian military objects.
That's the latest as we have it, that trip going ahead today. It's good to be able to hear from your side of things and how these developments are being received in Ukraine. Oleksandr Merezhko, thank you, Chair of Ukraine's Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee.
And that brings us to 17 minutes to nine. And a word about the Today debate, which took place last night. Michelle had a panel of guests. They were discussing how to make sure that everyone has somewhere safe to live in the wake of the Grenfell Inquiry report. And among her guests was Edward Dauphin, who survived the fire and is a member of the Grenfell United campaign group.
The culture within the construction industry that treated us like we didn't matter, that all needs to change. And people that work in construction need to build buildings with an understanding that there are people going to live in them, that those people are more important than profit or the time that it takes to build those buildings. And, you know, like, for me, it all comes back to this thing of, like, If we'd been respected as human, I know it sounds a bit funny, but if we'd been respected as human beings, and if they'd really thought and cared about us, Grenfell wouldn't have happened. And you know, what was important to all these different companies was profit. And, you know, for me, the Grenfell Tower Inquiry report needs to be a touchstone that puts people before profit. And anyone that works in government, local authorities, manufacturing, procurement, whenever they're about to make a decision, they need to think about Grenfell and they need to think about whether that decision is going to lead to people being put at risk and jeopardy.
That was there for Edward Dauphin from the Grenfell United Group, who joined Michelle last night for the Today debate. Also on the panel, the writer and broadcaster George Clark and the former Conservative Minister Robert Halfrin. You can hear the whole thing on Radio 4 at 11 o'clock, or you can listen back at any times on BBC Sounds.
A quarter to nine. Should we have a bit of this? I could just keep playing that for Florence and the Machine. Dog days are over, but let me tell you why we've got the treat of playing that music this morning. Because tonight, Florence Welch, she of Florence and the Machine fame, makes her Proms debut, and it's a celebration of her first album, Lungs, from which that song comes, released amazingly, I can't believe this, 15 years ago. She joins Jules Buckley, the Grammy Award-winning conductor and composer. He'll be conducting this show, which will be his, I'm told, 23rd BBC Prom. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Lovely to have you on the programme. And what an exciting evening for you. How are you feeling ahead of it?
I'm feeling really excited. Yeah, it's something really special. And we've been working for many months on this. So, yeah, absolutely can't wait.
How do you make that sort of music work with the orchestra?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think if you listen to that album, within that album, there are many components that, in a way, lend themselves naturally to orchestral treatment. You've got this incredible virtuosic harp playing from Tom Moth, Florence's harp player. You've got a whole swathe of percussion. I think literally the kitchen sink was thrown into that record. And you've got the sort of harmonic sequences of the songs, which are often very romantic as part of her storytelling. And so these three components alone, they lend themselves really well to setting it in the orchestral way. But don't be fooled. We're not going to be going in there and making it all kind of dainty and quaint. We're planning on sort of putting the pedal down.
I bet. Well, she's also mentioned, Florence, apparently in this interview in Vogue, that she wanted to incorporate medieval folk instruments. Has that been done?
It has been done. Yep, there are several instruments from the Renaissance period.
Like what?
We have the lute, for example, and we have the harpsichord. In fact, we have two lutes.
I mean, why stop at one when you can have two?
I know, yeah. They'll be bringing a certain angle on her music as well, which I think it really works. And I think that people will feel that in the room.
Is there a particular track on Lungs that stood out when you were composing it for an orchestra, or one that you're particularly excited about this evening?
There's one track that we're going to perform tonight, Birdsong. And this, you know, this moves around in tempo and in style and in its narrative. And I think the arrangement that's been written by Sam Gale is really brilliant. And I think that it's a good example of why, you know, having an artist like Florence at the Proms is a brilliant thing, and why the kind of the symbiosis between orchestra and artist is something that goes back a long way. And we're going to be looking forward to showing that off as well.
It must be also an amazing challenge for her to, I mean, she's obviously worked with live musicians for years and years, and she's got such a unique style and aesthetic and the way she presents herself. If you're not familiar, do go and look up. I say to those listeners who perhaps don't know quite what I'm talking about, but she it must be such a big thing for her to have this moment as well and work with the orchestra like this.
Yeah, I think for any creator, you know, at the time that you make an album or any piece of art, really, you're in a certain time and a certain place of your life. And so you're going through all the challenges of that age and what's happening that day and that week. And so I think to come back to that record after 15 years and to revisit it in great detail, you know, it will be bringing back such daunting and beautiful memories for her and for her team. And so I think for us to be a part of that is great, but I think especially for Florence, that's a journey that only she can truly describe. But it must have a lot of great feeling about it.
Well, I'm looking forward to catching up on it and being able to see how the magic comes to life. And I think it takes audiences back in time, which we're hearing a lot about at the moment, whether it's Oasis or other bands coming back and going back in time. Sometimes you don't want to revisit those moments, but sometimes it's the most joyous thing in the world. Jules Buckley, good luck for this evening. Thank you.
10 to 9 is the time. Healthcare workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo, who are at the front line of the Mpox outbreak, have been telling the BBC that they're desperate. We've been given rare access to an Mpox treatment centre in the worst affected region in the world, where infections are rising, and yet the medical staff there say they don't have any information about where they'll get vaccines. They're running out of supplies, and they say they are demotivated. Here's our Africa correspondent, Simi Jola Osho, with this special report.
The cries of babies are resounding here. As the number of infections rise, the age of the patients gets younger. Murhula Balume is the youngest mpox case at Luero's community hospital at only 4 weeks old. It's an agonizing ordeal for first-time mom, 18-year-old Faraja Rukara.
It's sad to see my firstborn suffering from this strange disease. I have a lot of pain in my heart. It's a very bad and dangerous disease.
Mpox has caused many to lose their appetite. They have become malnourished. Yvette Kabuya was relieved after her 10-month-old daughter, Amenipa, recovered from the disease, only to get ill herself. As babies pass on mpox to their parents, there's fear of a new wave of infections. This is the first time many here have encountered mpox. Beatrice Kachira rushed her 3-year-old granddaughter here in a panic.
I just saw the child get sick. I didn't even know the name of the disease. We can't sit and wait for the children and even adults to die. Bring on the vaccines.
Just over 3 weeks ago, this hospital was used to treat all sorts of diseases and conditions. They used to get around 80 patients a month. But the outbreak got so bad here, they had to convert it into an mpox-only treatment center. Now they've had nearly 200 patients in 3 weeks. Healthcare workers here say if the government doesn't step in quickly, things will only get worse. Remaining motivated is difficult for nurses like Emmanuel Fakiri, who's worked here for 4 years. Every day, he fears catching and passing mpox on to his own children, who are only 7, 5, and 1 year old.
We've learned from social media that the vaccine is already available. You saw how I touched the patients because that's my job as a nurse. So we are asking the government to help us by first giving us the vaccines.
It's a sentiment shared by his colleague, Dr. Pacific Carranzo, who's had to observe his patients share beds.
You will see that the patients are sleeping on the floor. As far as other challenges are concerned, there's still no staff motivation. Personal protective equipment, there isn't enough of it. We try to do what we can to look after the sick and not to put ourselves at risk either. We're not spared from the disease.
This region of the DR Congo has experienced a battle of control over its mineral-rich land for nearly 30 years, while South Kivu's governor, Jean-Jacques Purusi Sadiki, says the government is doing its best to get medics what they need. He told us the conflict was proving costly and making things harder.
We are facing many challenges. We don't have roads. I mean, the war is going on. We are accommodating thousands of IDPs. The country is losing a lot of money in trying to address this war. The medicine will come in less than 2 weeks. I'm going to Luiro myself. I will definitely deliver what is available in terms of urgent assistance. I am confident that we will succeed.
That certainty is not yet mirrored by staff at this mpox treatment center, whose dedication ensured there have been no deaths here. Yet, they promised to keep showing up despite the bleakness of what lies ahead.
Simi Jola Osho there with that report, our Africa correspondent. 6 minutes to 9. Let's turn our attention to TV soaps and their future. What of it? Falling ratings, cost-cutting is hitting soaps and TV drama across the board in certain parts of that of the media industry. And in the last few days, we learn EastEnders is going live for a full episode as part of its celebrations for its 40th anniversary in February. Very pleased to learn this morning that I'm turning 40 at the same time as EastEnders. But this time there'll be a twist, as audiences will have the power to decide the outcome of one storyline. And we also learn that Hollyoaks is going to jump forward by a whole year to let producers reduce the number of episodes and cast members. Let's get some reaction on this. Dorothy Hobson, a fellow of the Royal Television Society and author of The Drama of a Soap Opera, and Lisa Holdsworth, screenwriter and producer behind such shows as Waterloo Road and Call the Midwife, and once part of the Emmerdale writing team. A warm welcome to you both. Dorothy, I'll come to you. What do you make of these ideas and this helping soaps potentially face difficult times, tough ratings?
Well, they have got tough ratings, but the whole of TV has. But they...
they're expensive because they're on so many times a year. I think these ideas of what they're doing are actually innovative. They've got to, I mean, Hollyoaks, that is quite clever because what they're basically doing is a flashback in memories, which is a literary device. We all do that. So I can see, okay, the reason is that they've got to cut costs and very sadly cut jobs. But as a kind of device to catch up and make things different. EastEnders, of course, live episodes are classic. Everybody does them for anniversaries. They're a lot of work, but again, they bring the audience. I'd be a bit worried about letting the audience vote for the answer for the next story. However, they will have very carefully planned it, so they'll be happy with whatever the audience decide. And I think we've got to do it because they are so important. Soaps are such a vital part, both to the industry and to viewers. But particularly the soaps tell stories over a long period. I mean, Coronation Street's just completing a storyline about motor neuron disease, which has gone on for about a year. And it's been able to tell that story, which, however important short time dramas, single dramas or six episodes, they cannot do that. So we should actually be very supportive of anything that the producers do.
Can I bring in Lisa at this point? Lisa, when Dorothy says they're so important, you know, for those who have turned away from soaps as viewers, it's perhaps hard to make that case. But why do you think soaps still should be valued?
They're still where a lot of working class voices can be heard, and that needs to be preserved. We have precious little of that in British television drama at the moment. It's also where human stories are played out. If you look at the drama on the iPlayer at the moment, the BBC makes amazing drama, but so much of it is crime and murder and misery. When you go to a soap, you'll still get those stories, but told on a very human level with humour and all the rest of it, particularly the two northern soaps. And I'm afraid I have to disagree a little bit with Dorothy, who don't know very well, and we agree on most
things. Go for it.
I worry about this gimmickry. It really concerns me. I understand that cuts have to be cost and audiences have to be grabbed, but I think it only gives you a short-term return on the audience. And let's be clear, Coronation Street and Emmerdale still dominate the top 10 of the viewing figures this week. They're pretty much in every slot. But I think where it comes back to is strong characters and good writing. And the cost of the writing hasn't changed. You can still get great writers writing for amazing shows. I think that's where every producer has to look to. Look to your writers, look to strong stories. The things that pulled people in over the years, then giving Angie her divorce papers, 31 million. Didn't need a live episode, didn't need gimmickry, didn't need...
I know, but times have changed, crashing. Haven't they, Lisa? That's the issue. And whether people want to stay with those soaps in the same way.
They still have enormous audience loyalty. I mean, this is the time of year when you are capturing your audience because the night's drawing, the things get cold, everybody's a bit spent up after summer and people sit in front of the telly. So I think it's important to do big...